Yeah, that's probably it.
And when Doty turned up right here in the mill, he'd have a pleasant surprise. God knew he deserved one. Sammy opened the car door and laid little Walter on the passenger side. She'd given up on the child restraint seat months ago, too much of a pain in the ass, and besides, she was a very safe driver.
Good to see you, Sammy. A pause. Will you pray for my wife?
Sure, Mr. Sanders, no prob.
She started to get in the car, then remembered two things. That Georgia Rue had shoved her tit with her goddamn motorcycle boot, probably hard enough to leave a bruise. And that Andy Sanders, broken-hearted or not, was the town's first selectman.
Mr. Sanders?
Yes, Sammy?
Some of those cops were kind of rough out there. You might want to do something about that before it, you know, gets out of hand.
His unhappy smile didn't change.
Well, Sammy, I understand how you young people feel about police. I was young myself once, but we've got a pretty bad situation here. And the quicker we establish a little authority, the better off everyone will be. You understand that, don't you?
Sure, Sammy said.
What she understood was that grief, no matter how genuine, did not seem to impede a politician's flow of bullshit.
Well, I'll see you.
They're a good team, Andy said vaguely. Pete Randolph will see they all pull together, wear the same hat, do the same dance. Protect and serve, you know.
Sure,
Samantha said. The protect and serve dance, with the occasional tit kick thrown in. She pulled away with little Walter once more snoring on the seat. The smell of baby shit was terrific. She unrolled the windows, then looked in the rearview mirror. Mr. Sanders was still standing in the makeshift parking lot, which was now almost entirely deserted. He raised a hand to her. Sammy raised her own in turn, wondering just where Doty had stayed last night if she hadn't gone home. Then she dismissed it. It was really none of her concern, and flipped on the radio. The only thing she could get clearly was Jesus radio, and she turned it off again. When she looked up, Frankie de Lesseps was standing in the road in front of her with his hand up, just like a real cop. She had to stop the brake to keep from hitting him, then put her hand on the baby to keep him from falling. Little Walter awoke and began to blat.
Look what you did,
she yelled at Frankie, with whom she'd once had a two-day fling back in high school when Angie was at band camp.
The baby almost went on the floor.
Where's his seat?
Frankie leaned in her window, biceps bulging. Big muscles, little dick. That was Frankie de Lesseps. As far as Sammy was concerned, Angie could have him.
None of your beeswax.
A real cop might have written her up for the lip as much as the child restraint law, but Frankie only smirked.
You seen Angie?
No, this time it was the truth. She probably got caught out of town.
Although it seemed to Sammy that the ones in town were the ones who'd gotten caught.
What about Doty?
Sammy once again said no. She practically had to because Frankie might talk to Mr. Sanders.
Angie's car's at her house, Frankie said. I looked in the garage.
Egg whoop, they probably went off somewhere in Doty's Kia.
He seemed to consider this. They were almost alone now. The traffic jam was just a memory. Then he said,
Did Georgia hurt your booby, baby?
And before she could answer, he reached in and grabbed it. Not gently, either.
Want me to kiss it all better?
She slapped his hand. On her right, little Walter blatted and blatted. Sometimes she wondered why God had made men in the first place. She really did. Always blatting or grabbing, grabbing or blatting. Frankie wasn't smiling now.
You want to watch that shit,
he said. Things are different now.
What are you going to do, arrest me?
I'd think of something better than that, he said. Go on, get out of here, and if you do see Angie, tell her I want to see her.
She drove away mad, and she didn't like to admit this to herself, but it was true. A little frightened. Half a mile down the road, she pulled over and changed little Walter's diaper. There was a used diaper bag in back, but she was too mad to bother. She threw the shitty Pamper onto the shoulder of the road instead, not far from the big sign reading,
Jim Rennie's Used Cars. Foreign and domestic. Ask us for credit. You'll be wheeling because Big Jim is dealing.
She passed some kids on bikes and wondered again how long it would be before everyone was riding them. Except it wouldn't come to that. Someone would figure things out before it did. Just like in one of those disaster movies she enjoyed watching on TV while she was stoned. Volcanoes erupting in L.A., zombies in New York. And when things went back to normal, Frankie and Carter Thibodeau would revert to what they'd been before. Small-town losers with little or no jingle in their pockets. In the meantime, though, she might do well to keep a low profile. All in all, she was glad she kept her mouth shut about Doty. 8. Rusty listened to the blood pressure monitor begin its urgent beeping and knew they were losing the boy. Actually, they'd been losing him ever since the ambulance hell from the moment the ricochet struck him. But the sound of the monitor turned the truth into a headline. Rory should have been life-flighted to CMG immediately, right from where he'd been so grievously wounded. Instead, he was in an under-equipped operating room that was too warm. The air conditioning had been turned off to conserve the generator. Being operated on by a doctor who should have retired years ago, a physician's assistant who had never assisted in a neurosurgery case, and a single exhausted nurse who spoke up now.
V-fib, Dr. Haskell.
The heart monitor had joined in. Now it was a chorus.
I know, Ginny, I'm not deaf.
He paused.
Deaf. I mean, Christ.
For a moment, he and Rusty looked at each other over the boy's sheet-swaddled form. Haskell's eyes were clear, and with it, this was not the same stethoscope-equipped time server who had been plodding through the rooms and corridors of Kathy Russell for the last couple of years like a dull ghost. But he looked terribly old and frail.
We tried, Rusty said.
In truth, Haskell had done more than try. He'd reminded Rusty of one of those sports novels he'd loved as a kid, where the aging pitcher comes out of the bullpen for one more shot at glory in the seventh game of the World Series. But only Rusty and Ginny Tomlinson had been in the stands for this performance, and this time there would be no happy ending for the old warhorse. Rusty had started the saline drip, adding mannitol to reduce brain swelling. Haskell had left the OR at an actual run to do the blood work in the lab down the hall, a complete CBC. It had to be Haskell. Rusty was unqualified, and there were no lab techs. Catherine Russell was now hideously understaffed. Rusty thought the Dinsmore boy might be only a down payment on the price the town would eventually have to pay for that lack of personnel. It got worse. The boy was A-negative, and they had none in their small blood supply. They did, however, have O-negative, the universal donor, and had given Rory 4 units, which left exactly 9 more in supply. Giving it to the boy had probably been tantamount to pouring it down the scrub room drain, but none of them had said so. While the blood ran into him, Haskell sent Ginny down to the closet-sized cubicle that served as the hospital's library. She came back with a tattered copy of On Neurosurgery, a brief overview. Haskell operated with the book beside him, an otoscope laid across the pages to hold them down. Rusty thought he would never forget the whine of the saw, the smell of the bone dust in the unnaturally warm air, or the clot of jellied blood that oozed out after Haskell removed the bone plug. For a few minutes, Rusty had actually allowed himself to hope. With the pressure of the hematoma relieved by the burr hole, Rory's vital signs had stabilized, or tried to. Then, while Haskell was attempting to determine if the bullet fragment was within his reach, everything had started going downhill again, and fast. Rusty thought of the parents waiting and hoping against hope. Now, instead of wheeling Rory to the left outside the OR, toward Kathy Russell's ICU, where his folks might be allowed to creep in and see him, it looked like Rory would be taking a right, toward the morgue.
If this were an ordinary situation, I'd maintain life support and ask the parents about organ donation, Haskell said. But of course, if this were an ordinary situation, he wouldn't be here. And even if he was, I wouldn't be trying to operate on him using a goddamn Toyota manual.
He picked up the otoscope and threw it across the OR. It struck the green tiles, chipped one, and fell to the floor.
Do you want to administer epi, Doctor? Ginny asked.
Calm, cool, and collected, but she looked tired enough to drop in her tracks.
Was I not clear? I won't prolong this boy's agony.
Haskell reached toward the red switch on the back of the respirator. Some wit, twitch perhaps, had put a small sticker there that read, Booyah!
Do you want to express a contrary opinion, Rusty?
Rusty considered the question, then slowly shook his head. The Babinski test had been positive, indicating major brain damage. But the main thing was that there was just no chance. Never had been, really. Haskell flipped the switch. Rory Dinsmore took one labored breath on his own, appeared to try for a second one, and then gave up.
I make it. Haskell looked at the big clock on the wall. 5:15 p.m. Will you note that as the T.O.D., Ginny?
Yes, Doctor.
Haskell pulled down his mask, and Rusty noted with concern that the old man's lips were blue.
Let's get out of here, he said. The heat is killing me.
But it wasn't the heat. His heart was doing that. He collapsed halfway down the corridor on his way to give Alden and Shelley Dinsmore the bad news. Rusty got to administer epi after all, but it did no good. Neither did closed chest massage. Or the paddles. Time of death, 5:49 p.m. Ron Haskell outlived his last patient by exactly 34 minutes. Rusty sat down on the floor, his back against the wall. Ginny had given Rory's parents the news. From where he sat with his face in his hands, Rusty could hear the mother's shrieks of grief and sorrow. They carried well in the nearly empty hospital. She sounded as if she would never stop.
9.
Barbie thought that the chief's widow must once have been an extremely beautiful woman. Even now, with dark circles under her eyes and an indifferent choice of clothes, faded jeans, and what he was pretty sure was a pajama top, Brenda Perkins was striking. He thought, maybe smart people rarely lost their good looks. If they had good ones to begin with, that was. And he saw the clear light of intelligence in her eyes. Something else, too. She might be in mourning, but it hadn't killed her curiosity. And right now the object of her curiosity was him. She looked over his shoulder at Julia's car backing down the driveway and raised her hands to it. Where are you going? Julia leaned out the window and called. I have to make sure the paper gets out. I also have to go by Sweetbriar Rose and give Anson Wheeler the bad news. He's on sandwich detail tonight. Don't worry, Bren. Barbie's safe. And before Brenda could reply or remonstrate, Julia was off down Morin Street, a woman on a mission. Barbie wished he were with her. His only objective, the creation of 40 ham and cheese and 40 tuna sandwiches. With Julia gone, Brenda resumed her inspection. They were on opposite sides of the screen door. Barbie felt like a job applicant facing a tough interview.
Are you? Brenda asked.
Beg your pardon, ma'am?
Are you safe?
Barbie considered it. 2 days ago he would have said yes, of course he was. But on this afternoon he felt more like the soldier of Fallujah than the cook of Chester's Mill. He settled for saying he was housebroken, which made her smile.
Well, I'll have to make my own judgment on that, she said, even though right now my judgment isn't the best. I've suffered a loss.
I know, ma'am. I'm very sorry.
Thank you. He's being buried tomorrow, out of that cheesy little Bowie funeral home that continues to stagger along somehow, even though almost everyone in town uses Crosman's in Castle Rock. Folks call Stuart Bowie's establishment Bowie's Burying Barn. Stuart's an idiot and his brother Fernald's worse. But now they're all we have. All I have.
She sighed like a woman confronting some vast chore. And why not, Barbie thought. The death of a loved one may be many things. But work is certainly one of them. She surprised him by stepping out onto the stoop with him.
Walk round back with me, Mr. Barbara. I may invite you in later on, but not until I'm sure of you. Ordinarily, I'd take a character reference from Julia like a shot, but these are not ordinary times.
She was leading him along the side of the house over nicely clipped grass raked clear of autumn leaves. On the right was a board fence separating the Perkins home from its next-door neighbor, and on the left were nicely kept flower beds.
The flowers were my husband's bailiwick. I suppose you think that's a strange hobby for a law enforcement officer.
Actually, I don't.
I never did either, which makes us in the minority. Small towns harbor small imaginations. Grace Metalius and Sherwood Anderson were right about that.
Also, she said as they rounded the rear corner of the house and entered a commodious backyard, it will stay light out here longer. I have a generator, but it died this morning, out of fuel, I believe. There's a spare tank, but I don't know how to change it. I used to nag Howie about the generator. He wanted to teach me how to maintain it. I refused to learn, mostly out of spite. A tear overspilled one eye and trickled down her cheek. She wiped it away absently. I'd apologize to him now if I could. I admit he was right. I can't do that, can I? Barbie knew a rhetorical question when he heard one. It was just the canister, he said. I can change it out.
Thank you,
she said, leading him to a patio table with an igloo cooler sitting beside it. I was going to ask Henry Morrison to do it, and I was going to get more canisters of Burpees, too, but by the time I got down to the High Street this afternoon, Burpees was closed, and Henry was out at Dinsmore's Field along with everyone else. Do you think I'll be able to get extra canisters tomorrow?
Maybe, Barbie said. In truth, he doubted it.
I heard about the little boy, she said. Gina Buffalino from next door came over and told me. I'm terribly sorry. Will he live?
I don't know. And because intuition told him honesty would be the most direct route to this woman's trust, provisional though that might be, he added, I don't think so.
No. She sighed and wiped at her eyes again. No. It sounded very bad.
She opened the igloo.
I have water and Diet Coke. That was the only soft drink I allowed Howie to have. Which do you prefer?
Water, ma'am. She opened two bottles of Poland Spring and they drank. She looked at him with her sadly curious eyes.
Julia told me you want a key to the town hall. I understand why you want it. I also understand why you don't want Jim Rennie to know.
He may have to. The situation's changed. You see, she held up her hand and shook her head. Barbie ceased.
Before you tell me that, I want you to tell me about the trouble you had with Junior and his friends.
Ma'am, didn't your husband?
Howie rarely talked about his cases, but this one he did talk about. It troubled him, I think. I want to see if your story matches his. If it does, we can talk about other matters. If it doesn't, I'll invite you to leave, although you may take your bottle of water with you.
Barbie pointed to the little red shed by the left corner of the house. That your Jenny?
Yes.
If I change out the canister while we talk, will you be able to hear me?
Yes.
And you want the whole deal, right?
Yes, indeed. And if you call me ma'am again, I may have to brain you.
The door of the little generator shed was held shut with a hook and eye of shiny brass. The man who had lived here until yesterday had taken care of his things, although it was a shame about that lone canister. Barbie decided that no matter how this conversation went, he would take it upon himself to try and get her a few more tomorrow. In the meantime, he told himself, tell her everything she wants to know about that night. But it would be easier to tell with his back turned. He didn't like saying the trouble had happened because Angie McCain had seen him as a slightly overage boy toy. Sunshine rule, he reminded himself, and told his tale.
10. What he remembered most clearly about last summer was the James McMurtry song that seemed to be playing everywhere, Talking at the Texaco, it was called. And the line he remembered most clearly was the one about how, in a small town, we all must know our place. When Angie started standing too close to him while he was cooking, or pressing a breast against his arm while she reached for something he could have gotten for her, the line recurred. He knew who her boyfriend was, and he knew that Frankie de Lesseps was part of the town's power structure, if only by virtue of his friendship with Big Jim Rennie's son. Dale Barbara, on the other hand, was little more than a drifter. In the Chester's Mill scheme of things, he had no place. One evening, she had reached around his hip and given his crotch a light squeeze. He reacted, and he saw by her mischievous grin that she'd felt him react.
You can have one back, if you want, she said.
They'd been in the kitchen, and she'd twitched the hem of her skirt, a short one, up a little, giving him a quick glimpse of frilly pink underwear.
Fair's fair.
I'll pass, he said. And she stuck her tongue out at him. He'd seen similar hijinks in half a dozen restaurant kitchens,
had even played along from time to time. It might have amounted to no more than a young girl's passing lech for an older and moderately good-looking co-worker. But then Angie and Frankie broke up. And one night when Barbie was dumping the swill in the dumpster out back after closing, she'd put a serious move on him. He turned around and she was there, slipping her arms around his shoulders and kissing him. At first he kissed her back. Angie unlocked one arm long enough to take his hand and put it on her left breast. That woke his brain up. It was good breast, young and firm. It was also trouble. She was trouble. He tried to pull back, and when she hung on one-handed, her nails now biting into the nape of his neck, and tried to thrust her hips against him, he pushed her away with a little more force than he had intended. She stumbled against the dumpster, glared at him, touched the seat of her jeans, and glared harder.
Thanks. Now I've got crap all over my pants.
You should know when to let go, he said mildly.
You liked it.
Maybe, he said, but I don't like you. And when he saw the hurt and anger deepen on her face, he added, I mean, I do, just not that way. But of course, people have a way of saying what they really mean when they're shaken up. 4 nights later, in Dippers, someone poured a glass of beer down the back of his shirt. He turned and saw Frankie de Lesseps.
Did you like that, Barbie? If you did, I can do it again. It's $2 pitcher night. Of course, if you didn't, we can take it outside.
I don't know what she's told you, but it's wrong, Barbie said. The jukebox had been playing not the McMurtry song, but that was what he heard in his head. We all must know our place.
What she told me is she said no, and you went ahead and fucked her anyway. What do you outweigh her by, 100 pounds? That sounds like rape to me.
I didn't, knowing it was probably hopeless.
You want to go outside, motherfuck, or you too chicken?
Too chicken, Barbie said, and to his surprise, Frankie went away. Barbie decided he'd had enough beer and music for one night, and was getting up to go when Frankie returned. This time, not with a glass, but a pitcher. Don't do that, Barbie said, but of course Frankie paid no attention. Splash, in the face, a Bud Light shower. Several people laughed and applauded drunkenly.
You can come out now and settle this, Frankie said, or I can wait. Last call's coming, Barbie.
Barbie went, realizing it was then or later, and believing that if he decked Frankie fast before a lot of people could see, that would end it. He could even apologize and repeat that he'd never been with Angie. He wouldn't add that Angie had been coming on to him, although he supposed a lot of people knew it. Certainly Rose and Anson did. Maybe, with a bloody nose to wake him up, Frankie would see what seemed so obvious to Barbie. This was the little twit's idea of payback. At first, it seemed that it might work out that way. Frankie stood flat-footed on the gravel, his shadow cast two different ways by the glare of the sodium lights at either end of the parking lot, his fists held up like John L. Sullivan. Mean, strong, and stupid. Just one more small-town brawler. Used to putting his opponents down with one big blow, then picking them up and hitting them a bunch of little ones until they cried uncle. He shuffled forward and uncorked his not-so-secret weapon, an uppercut Barbie avoided by the simple expedient of cocking his head slightly to one side. Barbie countered with a straight jab to the solar plexus. Frankie went down with a stunned expression on his face. "We don't have to," Barbie began, and that was when Junior Rennie hit him from behind, in the kidneys, probably with his hands laced together to make one big fist. Barbie stumbled forward. Carter Thibodeau was there to meet him, stepping from between two parked cars and throwing a roundhouse. It might have broken Barbie's jaw if it had connected, but Barbie got his arm up in time. That accounted for the worst of his bruises, still an unlovely yellow when he tried to leave town on Dome Day. He twisted to one side, understanding this had been a planned ambush, knowing he had to get out before someone was really hurt. Not necessarily him. He was willing to run, he wasn't proud. He got 3 steps before Melvin Searles tripped him up. Barbie sprawled in the gravel on his belly and the kicking started. He covered his head, but a squall of boot leather pounded his legs, ass, and arms. One caught him high in the ribcage, just before he managed to knee-scramble behind Stubby Norman's used furniture panel truck. His good sense left him then, Annie stopped thinking about running away. He got up, faced them, then held out his hands to them, palms up and fingers wiggling, beckoning. The slot he was standing in was narrow. They'd have to come one by one. Junior tried first. His enthusiasm was rewarded with a kick in the belly. Barbie was wearing Nikes rather than boots, but it was a hard kick, and Junior folded up beside the panel truck, woofing for breath. Frankie scrambled over him, and Barbie popped him twice in the face, stinging shots, but not quite hard enough to break anything. Good sense had begun to reassert itself. Gravel crunched. He turned in time to catch incoming from Thibodeau, who had cut behind him. The blow connected with his temple. Barbie saw stars.
Or maybe one was a comet, he told Brenda, opening the valves on the new gas canister.
Thibodeau moved in. Barbie pistoned a hard kick to his ankle, and Thibodeau's grin turned to a grimace. He dropped to one knee, looking like a football player holding the ball for a field goal attempt. Except ball holders usually don't clutch their ankles. Absurdly, Carter Thibodeau cried,
"Fucking dirty fighter!"
"Look who's talk—" Barbie got that far before Melvin Searles locked an elbow around his throat. Barbie drove his own elbow back into Searles' midsection and heard the grunt of escaping air. Smelled it, too. Beer, cigarettes, Slim Jims. He was turning, knowing that Thibodeau would probably be on him again before he could fight his way entirely clear of the aisle between vehicles into which he had retreated, no longer caring. His face was throbbing, his ribs were throbbing, and he suddenly decided, it seemed quite reasonable, that he was going to put all four of them in the hospital. They could discuss what constituted dirty fighting and what did not, as they signed each other's casts. That was when Chief Perkins, called by either Tommy or Willow Anderson, the roadhouse proprietors, drove into the parking lot with his jackpots lit and his headlights winking back and forth. The combatants were illuminated like actors on a stage. Perkins hit the siren once. It blipped half a whoop and died. Then he got out, hitching his belt up over his considerable girth.
"Little early in the week for this, isn't it, fellas?"
To which Junior Rennie replied. 11. Brenda didn't need Barbie to tell her that. She'd heard it from Howie, and hadn't been surprised. Even as a child, Big Jim's boy had been a fluent confabulator, especially when his self-interest was at stake.
To which he replied, "The cook started it. Am I right?"
"Yep." Barbie pushed the Jenny start button, and it roared into life. He smiled at her, although he could feel a flush warming his cheeks. What he'd just told was not his favorite story, although he supposed he'd pick it over the one of the Jim in Fallujah any day.
"There you go. Lights, camera, action." "Thank you. How long will it last?"
"Only a couple of days, but this may be over by then."
"Or not. I suppose you know what saved you from a trip to the county lockup that night."
"Sure," Barbie said. "Your husband saw it happening, 4-on-1. It was kind of hard to miss."
"Any other cop might not have seen it, even if it was right in front of his eyes. And it was just luck Howie was on that night. George Frederick was supposed to have the duty, but he called him a stomach flu."
She paused.
"You might call it providence instead of luck."
"So I might," Barbie agreed.
"Would you like to come inside, Mr. Barbara?"
"Why don't we sit out here, if you don't mind? It's pleasant."
"Fine by me. The weather will turn cold soon enough." "Or will it?"
Barbie said he didn't know.
"When Howie got you all to the station, the Lessops told Howie that you raped Angie McCain. Isn't that how it went?"
"That was his first story. Then he said maybe it wasn't quite rape. But when she got scared and told me to stop, I wouldn't. That would make it rape in the second degree, I guess." She smiled briefly.
"Don't let any feminists hear you say there are degrees of rape."
"I guess I better not. Anyway, your husband put me in the interrogation room, which seems to be a broom closet when it's doing its day job." Brenda actually laughed. "Then hauled Angie in, sat her where she had to look me in the eye. Hell, we were almost rubbing elbows. It takes mental preparation to lie about something big, especially for a young person. I found that out in the army. Your husband knew it, too. Told her it would go to court. Explained the penalties for perjury. Long story short, she recanted, said there'd been no intercourse.
let alone rape.
Howie had a motto, reason before law. It was the basis for the way he handled things. It will not be the way Peter Randolph handles things. Partially because he's a foggy thinker, but mostly because he won't be able to handle Rennie. My husband could. Howie said that when news of your altercation got back to Mr. Rennie, he insisted that you be tried for something. He was furious. Did you know that?
No. But he wasn't surprised.
Howie told Mr. Rennie that if any of it made it into court, he'd see that all of it made it into court, including the 4-on-1 in the parking lot. He added that a good defense attorney might even be able to get some of Frankie and Junior's high school escapades into the record. There were several, although nothing quite like what happened to you. She shook her head. Junior Rennie was never a great kid, but he used to be relatively harmless. Over the last year or so, he's changed. Howie saw it and was troubled by it. I've discovered that Howie knew things about both the son and the father.
She trailed off. Barbie could see her debating whether or not to go on and deciding not to. She had learned discretion as the wife of a small-town police official, and it was a hard habit to unlearn.
Howie advised you to leave town before Rennie found some other way to make trouble for you, didn't he? I imagine you got caught by this dome thing before you could do it.
Yes to both. Can I have that Diet Coke now, Mrs. Perkins?
Call me Brenda, and I'll call you Barbie if that's what you go by. Please, help yourself to a soft drink.
Barbie did.
You want a key to the fallout shelter so you can get the Geiger counter. I can and will help you there. But it sounded like you were saying Jim Rennie has to know. And with that idea, I have trouble. Maybe it's grief clouding my mind, but I don't understand why you'd want to get into any kind of headbutting contest with him. Big Jim freaks out when anybody challenges his authority, and you he doesn't like to begin with. Nor does he owe you any favors. If my husband was still chief, maybe the two of you could go see Rennie together. I would have rather enjoyed that, I think.
She leaned forward, looking at him earnestly from her dark-circled eyes.
But Howie's gone, and you're apt to wind up in a cell instead of looking around for some mystery generator.
I know all that, but something new has been added. The Air Force is going to shoot a cruise missile at the dome tomorrow, at 1300 hours.
Oh, my Jesus.
They've shot other missiles at it, but only to determine how high the barrier goes. Radar doesn't work. Those had dummy warheads. This one will have a very live one. A bunker buster. She paled visibly.
What part of our town are they going to shoot it at?
Point of impact will be where the dome cuts Little Bitch Road. Julia and I were out there just last night. It'll explode about 5 feet off the ground. Her mouth dropped open in an unladylike gape.
Not possible.
I'm afraid it is. They'll release it from a B-52, and it'll fly a pre-programmed course. I mean, really programmed. Down to every ridge and dip once it descends to target height. Those things are eerie. If it explodes and doesn't break through, it means everyone in town just gets a bad scare. It's going to sound like Armageddon. If it does break through, though... Her hand had gone to her throat.
How much damage? Bobby, we have no fire trucks.
I'm sure they'll have fire equipment standing by. As to how much damage... He shrugged. The whole area will have to be evacuated, that's for sure.
Is it wise? Is what they're planning wise?
It's a moot question, Mrs. Brenda. They've made their decision. But it gets worse, I'm afraid. And seeing her expression. For me, not the town. I've been promoted to colonel. By presidential order. She rolled her eyes.
How nice for you.
I'm supposed to declare martial law and basically take over Chester's Mill. Won't Jim Rennie enjoy hearing that? She surprised him by bursting into laughter, and Barbie surprised himself by joining her. You see my problem? The town doesn't have to know about me borrowing an old Geiger counter, but they do need to know about the bunker buster coming their way. Julia Shumway will spread the news if I don't, but the town fathers ought to hear it from me, because...
I know why.
Thanks to the reddening sun, Brenda's face had lost its pallor, but she was rubbing her arms absently.
If you're to establish any authority here, which is what your superior wants you to do.
I guess Cox is more like my colleague now, Barbie said. She sighed.
Andrea Grinnell. We'll take this to her. Then we'll talk to Rennie and Andy Sanders together. At least we'll outnumber them. 3-2.
Rose's sister? Why?
You don't know she's the town's third selectman?
And when he shook his head,
don't look so chagrined. Many don't. Although she's held the job for several years, she's usually little more than a rubber stamp for the two men, which means for Rennie, since Andy Sanders is a rubber stamp himself, and she has problems. But there's a core of toughness there. Or was.
What problems? He thought she might keep that to herself, too, but she didn't.
Drug dependency. Pain pills. I don't know how bad it is.
And I suppose she gets her scripts filled at Sanders' pharmacy.
Yes, I know it's not a perfect solution and you'll have to be very careful, but Jim Rennie may be forced by simple expediency to accept your input for a while. Your actual leadership...
She shook her head.
He'll wipe his bottom with any declaration of martial law, whether it's signed by the president or not. I...
She ceased. Her eyes were looking past him and widening. Mrs. Perkins, Brenda, what is it?
Oh, she said. Oh, my God.
Barbie turned to look and was stunned to silence himself. The sun was going down red, as it often did after warm, fair days, unsullied by late showers. But never in his life had he seen a sunset like this one. He had an idea. The only people who ever had were those in the vicinity of violent volcanic eruptions. No, he thought, not even them. This is brand new. The declining sun wasn't a ball. It was a huge red bow-tie shape with a burning circular center. The western sky was smeared as if with a thin film of blood that shaded to orange as it climbed. The horizon was almost invisible through that blurry glare.
God Christ. It's like trying to look through a dirty windshield when you're driving into the sun, she said.
And of course that was it. Only the dome was the windshield. It had begun to collect dust and pollen, pollutants as well. And it would get worse. We'll have to wash it, he thought. And visualized lines of volunteers with buckets and rags. Absurd. How were they going to wash it 40 feet up? Or 140? Or 1,000?
This has to end, she whispered. Call them and tell them to shoot the biggest missile they can and damn the consequences. Because this has to end.
Barbie said nothing. Wasn't sure he could have spoken even if he had something to say. That vast, dusty glare had stolen his words. It was like looking through a porthole into hell.
Nyak, nyak, nyak.
1. Jim Rennie and Andy Sanders watched the weird sunset from the steps of the Bowie funeral home. They were due at the town hall for another emergency assessment meeting at 7 o'clock, and Big Jim wanted to be there early to prepare. But for now, they stood where they were, watching the day die its strange, smeary death.
It's like the end of the world.
Andy spoke in a low, awestruck voice.
Bull pucky, Big Jim said.
And if his voice was harsh, even for him, it was because a similar thought had been going through his own mind. For the first time since the dome had come down, it had occurred to him that the situation might be beyond their ability to manage. His ability to manage. And he rejected the idea furiously.
Do you see Christ the Lord coming down from the sky?
No,
Andy admitted. What he saw were townspeople he'd known all his life standing in clumps along Main Street. Not talking, only watching that strange sunset with their hands shading their eyes.
Do you see me? Big Jim persisted.
Andy turned to him.
Sure I do,
he said, sounding perplexed.
Sure I do, Big Jim.
Which means I haven't been raptured, Big Jim said. I gave my heart to Jesus years ago, and if it was end times, I wouldn't be here. Neither would you, right?
Guess not, Andy said, but he felt doubtful.
If they were saved, washed in the blood of the Lamb, why had they just been talking to Stuart Bowie about shutting down what Big Jim called our little business? And how had they gotten into such a business to start with? What did running a meth factory have to do with being saved? If he asked Big Jim, Andy knew what the answer would be. The ends sometimes justify the means. The ends in this case had seemed admirable, once upon a time. The new Holy Redeemer Church, the old one, had been little more than a clapboard shack with a wooden cross on top. The radio station that had saved only God knew how many souls. The 10% they tithed, prudently, the contribution checks issued from a bank in the Cayman Islands, to the Lord Jesus Missionary Society, to help what Pastor Coggins liked to call the Little Brown Brothers. But looking at that huge, blurry sunset that seemed to suggest all human affairs were tiny and unimportant, Andy had to admit those things were no more than justifications. Without the cash income from the meth, his drugstore would have gone under 6 years ago. The same with the funeral home. The same, probably, although the man beside him would never admit it, with Jim Rennie's used cars. I know what you're thinking, pal, Big Jim said.
Andy looked up timidly. Big Jim was smiling. But not the fierce one. This one was gentle, understanding. Andy smiled back, or tried to. He owed Big Jim a lot. Only now things like the drugstore and Claudie's BMW seemed a lot less important. What good was a BMW, even one with self-parking and a voice-activated sound system, to a dead wife? When this is over and Dodie comes back, I'll give the Beamer to her, Andy decided. It's what Claudie would have wanted. Big Jim raised a blunt-fingered hand to the declining sun that seemed to be spreading across the western sky like a great poisoned egg.
You think all this is our fault, somehow? That God is punishing us for propping up the town when times were hard? That's just not true, pal. This isn't God's work. If you wanted to say getting beat in Vietnam was God's work, God's warning that America was losing her spiritual way, I'd have to agree with you. If you were to say that 9/11 was the Supreme Being's response to our Supreme Court telling little children they could no longer start their day with a prayer to the God who made them, I'd have to go along. But God punishing Chester's Mill because we didn't want to end up just another moribund wide spot in the road, like Jay or Millinocket? He shook his head. No, sir. No.
We also put some pretty good change in our own pockets, Andy said timidly.
This was true. They had done more than prop up their own businesses and extend a helping hand to the Little Brown Brothers. Andy had his own account in the Cayman Islands. And for every dollar Andy had, or the Bowies for that matter, he was willing to bet that Big Jim had put away three, maybe even four. The workman is worthy of his hire, Big Jim said in a pedantic but kindly tone. Matthew 10:10. He neglected to cite the previous verse. Provide neither gold nor silver nor brass in your purses. He looked at his watch.
Speaking of work, pal, we better get moving. Got a lot to decide.
He started walking, and he followed, not taking his eyes off the sunset, which was still bright enough to make him think of infected flesh. Then Big Jim stopped again.
Anyway, you heard, Stuart, we're shut down out there. All done and buttoned up, as the little boy said after he made his first wee.
He told the chef himself.
That guy,
Andy said dourly. Big Jim chuckled.
Don't you worry about Phil. We're shut down, and we're going to stay shut down until the crisis is over. In fact, this might be a sign that we're supposed to close up shop forever. A sign from the Almighty.
That would be good, Andy said.
but he had a depressing insight. If the dome disappeared, Big Jim would change his mind. And when he did, Andy would go along. Stuart Bowie and his brother Fernald would, too, eagerly. Partly because the money was so unbelievable, not to mention tax-free, and partly because they were in too deep. He remembered something some long-ago movie star had said. By the time I discovered I didn't like acting, I was too rich to quit. "Don't worry so much," Big Jim said. "We'll start moving the propane back into town in a couple of weeks, whether this dome situation resolves itself or not. We'll use the town sand trucks. You can drive a standard shift, can't you?"
"Yes,"
Andy said glumly. "And," Big Jim brightened as an idea struck him, "we can use Stewie's hearse, then we can move some of the canisters even sooner." Andy said nothing. He hated the idea that they had appropriated, that was Big Jim's word for it, so much propane from various town sources. But it had seemed the safest way. They were manufacturing on a large scale, and that meant a lot of cooking and a lot of venting the bad gases. Big Jim had pointed out that buying propane in large amounts could raise questions, just as buying large amounts of the various over-the-counter drugs that went into the crap might be noticed and cause trouble. Owning a drugstore had helped with that, although the size of his orders for stuff like Robitussin and Sudafed had made Andy horribly nervous. He thought that would be their downfall, if their downfall came. He had never considered the huge cache of propane tanks behind the WCIK studio building until now. "By the way, we'll have plenty of electricity in the town hall tonight." Big Jim spoke with the air of one springing a pleasant surprise. "I had Randolph send my boy and his friend Frankie over to the hospital to grab one of their tanks for our Jenny." Andy looked alarmed.
"But we already took..."
"I know," Rennie said soothingly. "I know we did. Don't you worry about Kathy Russell. They've got enough for the time being."
"You could have gotten one from the radio station. There's so much out there."
"This was closer," Big Jim said. "And safer. Pete Randolph's our guy, but that doesn't mean I want him to know about our little business. Now or ever." This made Andy even more certain that Big Jim didn't really want to give up the factory.
"Jim, if we start sneaking LP back into town, where will we say it was? Are we going to tell folks the gas fairy took it, then changed his mind and gave it back?"
Rennie frowned. "Do you think this is funny, pal?"
"No, I think it's scary."
"I've got a plan. We'll announce a town fuel supply depot and ration propane from it as needed. Heating oil, too, if we can figure out how to use it with the power out. I hate the idea of rationing. It's un-American to the core. But this is like the story of the grasshopper and the ant, you know. There are cotton pickers in town who'd use up everything in a month, then yell at us to take care of them at the first sign of a cold snap."
"You don't really think this will go on for a month, do you?"
"Of course not, but you know what the old-timers say. Hope for the best, prepare for the worst." Andy thought of pointing out that they'd already used a fair amount of the town's supplies to make crystal meth. But he knew what Big Jim would say. "How could we possibly have known?" They couldn't have, of course. Who in their right mind would ever have expected this sudden contraction of all resources? You planned for more than enough. It was the American way. Not nearly enough was an insult to the mind and the spirit. Andy said,
"You're not the only one who won't like the idea of rationing."
"That's why we have a police force. I know we all mourn Howie Perkins' passing, but he's with Jesus now, and we got Pete Randolph, who's going to be better for the town in this situation, because he listens." He pointed a finger at Andy. "The people in a town like this, people everywhere, really, aren't much more than children when it comes to their own self-interest. How many times have I said that?"
"Lots," Andy said, and sighed.
"What do you have to make children do?"
"Eat their vegetables if they want their dessert."
"Yes, and sometimes that means cracking the whip."
That reminds me of something else,
Andy said.
I was talking to Sammy Bushy out at Dinsmore's Field, one of Doty's friends.
She said some of the cops were pretty rough out there, darn rough. We might want to talk to Chief Randolph about that.
Jim frowned at him.
What did you expect, pal? Kid gloves? There was darn near a riot out there. We almost had a cotton-picking riot right here in Chester's Mill.
I know, you're right, it's just that...
I know the Bushy girl.
Knew her whole family.
Drug users, car thieves, scofflaws, loan dodgers, and tax dodgers. What we used to call poor white trash, before it became politically incorrect. Those are the people we have to watch out for right now. The very people. They're the ones who'll tear this town apart, given half a chance. Is that what you want?
No, of course not.
But Big Jim was in full flight. Every town has its ants, which is good, and its grasshoppers, which aren't so good, but we can live with them because we understand them and can make them do what's in their own best interests, even if we have to squeeze them a little.
But every town also has its locusts, just like in the Bible, and that's what people like the Bushies are.
On them, we got to bring the hammer down. You might not like it, and I might not like it, but personal freedom's going to have to take a hike until this is over. And we'll sacrifice, too. Aren't we going to shut down our little business?
Andy didn't want to point out that they really had no choice, since they had no way of shipping the stuff out of town anyway, but settled for a simple yes. He didn't want to discuss things any further, and he dreaded the upcoming meeting, which might drag on until midnight. All he wanted was to go home to his empty house and have a stiff drink, and then lie down, and think about Claudie, and cry himself to sleep. What matters right now, pal, is keeping things on an even keel. That means law and order and oversight. Our oversight, because we're not grasshoppers. We're ants. Soldier ants. Big Jim considered. When he spoke again, his tone was all business.
I'm rethinking our decision to let Food City continue on a business-as-usual basis. I'm not saying we're going to shut it down. At least not yet. But we'll have to watch it pretty closely over the next couple of days. Like a cotton-picking hawk. Same with the gas and grocery. And it might not be a bad idea if we were to appropriate some of the more perishable food for our own personal...
He stopped, squinting at the town hall steps. He didn't believe what he saw and raised a hand to block the sunset. It was still there. Brenda Perkins and that gosh darn troublemaker, Dale Barbara. Not side by side, either. Sitting between them and talking animatedly to Chief Perkins' widow was Andrea Grinnell, the third selectman. They appeared to be passing sheets of paper from hand to hand. Big Jim did not like this. At all. 2. He started forward, meaning to put a stop to the conversation no matter the subject. Before he could get half a dozen steps, a kid ran up to him. It was one of the Killian boys. There were about a dozen Killians living on a ramshackle chicken farm out by the Tarker's Mills town line. None of the kids was very bright, which they came by honestly, considering the parents from whose shabby loins they had sprung. But all were members in good standing at Holy Redeemer. All saved, in other words. This one was Ronnie. At least Rennie thought so, but it was hard to be sure. They all had the same bullet heads, bulging brows, and beaky noses. The boy was wearing a tattered WCIK t-shirt and carrying a note.
"Hey, Mr. Rennie," he said. "Sorry, I've been looking all over town for you."
"I'm afraid I don't have time to talk right now, Ronnie," Big Jim said. He was still looking at the trio sitting on the town hall steps. The three gosh darn stooges.
"Maybe tomorrow." "It's Richie, Mr. Rennie. Ronnie's my brother."
"Richie, of course. Now, if you'll excuse me." Big Jim strode on. Andy took the note from the boy and caught up to Rennie before he could get to the trio sitting on the steps.
"You better look at this."
What Big Jim looked at first was Andy's face, more pinched and worried than ever. Then he took the note. "James, I must see you tonight. God has spoken to me. Now I must speak to you before I speak to the town. Please reply. Richie Killian will carry your message to me. Reverend Lester Coggins. Not Les. Not even Lester. No, Reverend Lester Coggins. This was not good. Why, oh why, did everything have to happen at the same time? The boy was standing in front of the bookstore, looking in his faded shirt and baggy, slipping-down jeans like a gosh-darn orphan. Big Jim beckoned to him. The kid raced forward eagerly. Big Jim took his pen from his pocket, written in gold down the barrel, "You'll love the feeling when Big Jim's dealing," and scribbled a three-word reply, "Midnight, my house." He folded it over and handed it to the boy. "Take that back to him and don't read it." "I won't, no way. God bless you, Mr. Rennie." "You too, son." He watched the boy speed off.
"What's that about?"
Andy asked. And before Big Jim could answer, "The factory is at the meth..."
"Shut up."
Andy fell back a step, shocked. Big Jim had never told him to shut up before. This could be bad. "One thing at a time," Big Jim said, and marched forward toward the next problem. 3. Watching Rennie come, Barbie's first thought was, he walks like a man who's sick and doesn't know it. He also walked like a man who has spent his life kicking ass. He was wearing his most carnivorously sociable smile as he took Brenda's hands and gave them a squeeze. She allowed this with calm, good grace. "Brenda," he said, "my deepest condolences. I would have been over to see you before now, and of course I'll be at the funeral. But I've been a little busy. We all have." "I understand," she said. "We miss Duke so much," Big Jim said.
"That's right," Andy put in, pulling up behind Big Jim. "A tugboat in the wake of an ocean liner. We sure do.
Thank you both so much.
And while I'd love to discuss your concerns, I can see that you have them." Big Jim's smile widened, although it did not come within hailing distance of his eyes. "We have a very important meeting. Andrea, I wonder if you'd like to run on ahead and sit out those files."
Although pushing 50, Andrea at that moment looked like a child who has been caught sneaking hot tarts off a windowsill. She started to get up, wincing at the pain in her back as she did so. But Brenda took her arm, and firmly, Andrea sat back down. Barbie realized that both Grinnell and Sanders looked frightened to death. It wasn't the dome, at least not at this moment. It was Rennie. Again, he thought, this is not as bad as it gets.
"I think you'd better make time for us, James," Brenda said pleasantly. "Surely you understand that if this wasn't important, very, I'd be at home, mourning my husband."
Big Jim was at a rare loss for words. The people on the street who'd been watching the sunset were now watching this impromptu meeting instead, perhaps elevating Barbara to an importance he did not deserve, simply because he was sitting in close proximity to the town's third selectman and the late police chief's widow, passing some piece of paper among themselves as if it were a letter from the Grand High Pope of Rome. Whose idea had this public display been? The Perkins woman's, of course. Andrea wasn't smart enough, nor brave enough to cross him in such a public way.
"Well, maybe we can spare you a few minutes. Eh, Andy?"
"Sure," Andy said. "Always a few minutes for you, Mrs. Perkins. I'm really sorry about Duke."
"And I'm sorry about your wife," she said gravely.
Their eyes met. It was a genuine, tender moment, and it made Big Jim feel like tearing his hair out. He knew he wasn't supposed to let such feelings grip him. It was bad for his blood pressure, and what was bad for his blood pressure was bad for his heart. But it was hard sometimes, especially when you'd just been handed a note from a fellow who knew far too much and now believed God wanted him to speak to the town. If Big Jim was right about what had gotten into Coggins' head, This current business was piddling, by comparison. Only it might not be piddling. Because Brenda Perkins had never liked him, and Brenda Perkins was the widow of a man who was now perceived in town, for absolutely no good reason, as a hero. The first thing he had to do... "Come on inside," he said. "We'll talk in the conference room." His eyes flicked to Barbie. "Are you part of this, Mr. Barbara? Because I can't for the life of me understand why." "This may help," Barbie said, holding out the sheets of paper they'd been passing around. "I used to be in the Army. I was a lieutenant. It seems that I've had my term of service extended. I've also been given a promotion." Rennie took the sheets, holding them by the corner as if they might be hot. The letter was considerably more elegant than the grubby note Richie Killian had handed him, and from a rather more well-known correspondent. The heading read simply, "From the White House." It bore today's date. Rennie felt the paper. A deep vertical crease had formed between his bushy eyebrows. "This isn't White House stationery." "Of course it is, you silly man," Barbie was tempted to say. "It was delivered an hour ago by a member of the FedEx Elf Squad. Crazy little fucker just teleported through the dome, no problem." "No, it's not." Barbie tried to keep his voice pleasant. "It came by way of the Internet as a PDF file. Miss Shumway downloaded it and printed it out." "Julia Shumway. Another troublemaker."
"Read it, James," Brenda said quietly. "It's important."
Big Jim read it.
4.
Benny Drake, Norrie Calvert, and Scarecrow Joe McClatchy stood outside the offices of the Chester's Mill Democrat. Each had a flashlight. Benny and Joe held theirs in their hands. Norrie's was tucked into the wide front pocket of her hoodie. They were looking up the street at the town hall, where several people, including all three selectmen and the cook from Sweetbriar Rose, appeared to be having a conference.
"I wonder what that's about," Norrie said.
"Grown-up shit," Benny said, with a supreme lack of interest, and knocked on the door of the newspaper office. When there was no response, Joe pushed past him and tried the knob. The door opened. He knew at once why Miss Shumway hadn't heard them. Her copier was going full blast while she talked with the paper's sports reporter and the guy who had been taking pictures out of the field day. She saw the kids and waved them in. Single sheets were shooting rapidly in the copier's tray. Pete Freeman and Tony Gay were taking turns pulling them out and stacking them up.
"There you are," Julia said. "I was afraid you kids weren't coming. We're almost ready. If the damn copier doesn't shit the bed, that is."
Joe, Benny, and Norrie received this enchanting bon mot with silent appreciation, each resolving to put it to use as soon as possible.
"Did you get permission from your folks?" Julia asked. "I don't want a bunch of angry parents on my neck." "Yes, ma'am," Norrie said. "All of us did."
Freeman was tying up a bundle of sheets with twine. "Doing a bad job of it, too," Norrie observed.
She herself could tie 5 different knots. Also fishing flies. Her father had shown her.
She, in turn, had shown him how to do nosies on her rail. And when he fell off the first time, he laughed until tears rolled down his face. She thought she had the best dad in the universe.
"Want me to do that?"
Norrie asked. "If you can do a better job, sure." Pete stood aside. She started forward, Joe and Benny crowding close behind her. Then she saw the big black headline on the one sheet extra and stopped.
"Holy shit!"
As soon as the words were out, she clapped her hands to her mouth, but Julia only nodded.
"It's an authentic holy shit, all right. I hope you all brought bikes, and I hope they all have baskets. You can't haul these around town on skateboards."
"That's what you said. That's what we brought," Joe replied. "Mine doesn't have a basket, but it's got a carrier."
"And I'll tie his load on for him," Norrie said.
Pete Freeman, who was watching with admiration as the girl quickly tied up the bundles, with what looked like a sliding butterfly, said,
"I bet you will. Those are good."
"Yeah, I rock," Norrie said matter-of-factly. "Got flashlights?" Julia asked.
"Yes,"
they all said together.
"Good. The Democrat hasn't used newsboys in 30 years, and I don't want to celebrate the reintroduction of the practice with one of you getting hit on the corner of Main or Prestille."
"That would be a bummer, all right," Joe agreed.
"Every house and business on those two streets gets one, right?"
plus Morin and St. Anne Avenue.
After that, spread out. Do what you can, but when it gets to be 9 o'clock, go on home. Drop any leftover papers on street corners. Put a rock on them to hold them down.
Benny looked at the headline again. Chester's Mill. Attention. Explosives to be fired at barrier. Cruise missile delivery system. Western border evacuation recommended.
I bet this won't work, Joe said darkly, examining the map, obviously hand-drawn, at the bottom of the sheet. The border between Chester's Mill and Tarker's Mills had been highlighted in red. There was a black X where Little Bitch Road cut across the town line. The X had been labeled Point of Impact.
Bite your tongue, kiddo, Tony Gay said.
5.
From the White House. Greetings and salutations to the Chester's Mill Board of Selectmen. Andrew Sanders, James P. Rennie, Andrea Grinnell. Dear sirs and madam, first and foremost I send you greetings and want to express our nation's deep concern and good wishes. I have designated tomorrow as a national day of prayer. Across America, churches will be open as people of all faiths pray for you and for those working to understand and reverse what has happened at the borders of your town. Let me assure you that we will not rest until the people of Chester's Mill are freed and those responsible for your imprisonment are punished. That this situation will be resolved, and soon, is my promise to you and to the people of Chester's Mill. I speak with all the solemn weight of my office as your commander-in-chief. 2. This letter will introduce Colonel Dale Barbara of the U.S. Army. Colonel Barbara served in Iraq, where he was awarded the Bronze Star, a Merit Service Medal, and 2 Purple Hearts. He has been recalled to duty and promoted so that he may serve as your conduit to us and ours to you. I know that, as loyal Americans, you will afford him every assistance. As you aid him, so will we aid you. My original intent, in accordance with the advice given me by the Joint Chiefs and the Secretaries of Defense and Homeland Security, was to invoke martial law in Chester's Mill and appoint Colonel Barbara as interim military governor. Colonel Barbara has assured me, however, that this will not be necessary. He tells me he expects full cooperation from selectmen and local police. He believes his position should be one of advise and consent. I have agreed to his judgment, subject to review. 3, I know you are worried about your inability to call friends and loved ones. We understand your concern, but it is imperative that we maintain this telephonic blackout to lower the risk of classified information passing into and out of Chester's Mill. You may think this a specious concern. I assure you, it is not. It may very well be that someone in Chester's Mill has information regarding the barrier surrounding your town. In-town calls should go through. 4, we will continue to maintain a press blackout for the time being, although this matter will remain subject to review. There may come a time when it would be beneficial for town officials and Colonel Barbara to hold a press conference. But at present our belief is that a speedy end to this crisis will render such a meeting with the press moot. My 5th point concerns internet communications. The Joint Chiefs are strongly in favor of a temporary blackout on email communications, and I was inclined to agree. Colonel Barbara, however, has argued strongly in favor of allowing the citizens of Chester's Mill continued internet access. He points out that email traffic can be legally monitored by the NSA, and as a practical matter, such communications can be vetted more easily than cell transmissions. Since he is our man on the spot, I have agreed to this point, partly on humanitarian grounds. This decision, however, will also be subject to review. Changes in policy may occur. Colonel Barbara will be a full participant in such reviews, and we look forward to a smooth working relationship between him and all town officials. 6, I offer you the strong possibility that your ordeal may end as early as tomorrow at 1 p.m. EDT. Colonel Barbara will explain the military operation
that will occur at that time, and he assures me that between the good offices of yourselves and Miss Julia Shumway, who owns and operates the local newspaper, you will be able to inform the citizens of Chester's Mill what to expect. And last, you are citizens of the United States of America, and we will never abandon you. Our firmest promise, based on our finest ideals, is simple. No man, woman, or child left behind. Every resource we need to employ in order to end your confinement will be employed. Every dollar we need to spend will be spent. What we expect from you in return is faith and cooperation. Please give us both. With every prayer and every good wish, I remain most sincerely yours. 6. Whatever scribble-dee-dee dog's body might have written it, the bastard had signed it himself, and using all three of his names, including the terrorist one in the middle. Big Jim hadn't voted for him, and at this moment, had he teleported into existence in front of him, Rennie felt he could cheerfully have strangled him. And Barbara. Big Jim's fondest wish was that he could whistle up Pete Randolph and have Colonel Fry Cook slammed into a cell. Tell him he could run his gosh darned martial law command from the basement of the cop shop with Sam Verdreau serving as his aide-de-camp. Maybe Sloppy Sam could even hold the DTs at bay long enough to salute without sticking his thumb in his eye. But not now. Not yet. Certain phrases from the Blackguard and Chief's letter stood out. As you aid him, so will we aid you. A smooth working relationship with all town officials. This decision will be subject to review. What we expect is faith and cooperation. That last one was the most telling. Big Jim was sure the pro-abortion son of a buck knew nothing about faith. To him, it was just a buzzword. But when he spoke of cooperation, he knew exactly what he was saying. And so did Jim. It's a velvet glove, but don't forget the iron fist inside it. The president offered sympathy and support. He saw the drug-addled Grinnell woman actually tear up as she read the letter. But if you look between the lines, you saw the truth. It was a threat letter, pure and simple. Cooperate, or you lose your internet. Cooperate, because we'll be making a list of who's naughty and who's nice. And you don't want to be on the naughty side of the ledger when we break through. Because we will remember. Cooperate, pal. Or else. Rennie thought, I will never turn my town over to a short-order cook who dared to lay a hand on my son and then dared to challenge my authority. That will never happen, you monkey. Never. He also thought, softly, calmly. Let Colonel Frycook explain the military's big plan. If it worked, fine. If it didn't, the U.S. Army's newest colonel was going to discover whole new meanings to the phrase deep in enemy territory. Big Jim smiled and said, Let's go inside, shall we? Seems we have a lot to talk about. 7. Junior sat in the dark with his girlfriends. It was strange. Even he thought so. But it was also soothing. When he and the other new deputies had gotten back to the police station after the colossal fuck-up in Dinsmore's Field, Stacy Moggin, still in uniform herself and looking tired, had told them they could have another 4 duty hours if they wanted. There was going to be plenty of overtime on offer, at least for a while, and when it came time for the town to pay, Stacy said she was sure there'd be bonuses as well, probably provided by a grateful United States government. Carter, Mel, Georgia Rue, and Frank DeLesseps had all agreed to work the extra hours. It wasn't really the money. They were getting off on the job. Junior was, too, but he'd also been hatching another of his headaches. This was depressing after feeling absolutely tip-top all day. He told Stacy he'd pass if that was all right. She assured him it was, but reminded him he was scheduled back on duty tomorrow at 7 o'clock. "There'll be plenty to do," she said. On the steps, Frankie hitched up his belt and said,
I think I'll swing by Angie's house. She probably went someplace with Dodie, but I'd hate to think she slipped in the shower. That she's lying there all paralyzed or something. Junior felt a throb go through his head. A small white spot began to dance in front of his left eye. It seemed to be jigging and jagging with his heartbeat, which had just speeded up. I'll go by if you want, he told Frankie. It's on my way. Really? You don't mind? Junior shook his head. The white spot in front of his eye darted crazily, sickeningly when he did. Then it settled again. Frankie lowered his voice.
Sammy Bushy gave me some lip
out at the field day.
That hole, Junior said.
No doubt. She goes, what are you going to do? Arrest me? Frankie raised his voice to a snarky falsetto that scraped Junior's nerves. The dancing white spot actually seemed to turn red, and for a moment he considered putting his hands around his old friend's neck and choking the life out of him so that he, Junior, would never have to be subjected to that falsetto again. What I'm thinking, Frankie continued, is I might go out there after I'm off. Teach her a lesson. You know, respect your local police.
She's a skank. Also, a lesberini.
That might make it even better.
Frankie had paused, looking toward the weird sunset.
This dome thing could have an upside. We can do pretty much whatever we want.
For the time being, anyway.
Consider it, chum.
Frankie squeezed his crotch.
Sure, Junior had replied, but I'm not particularly horny.
Except now he was. Well, sort of. It wasn't like he was going to fuck them or anything, but...
But you're still my girlfriends, Junior said in the darkness of the pantry.
He'd used a flashlight at first, but then had turned it off. The dark was better.
Aren't you?
They didn't reply. If they did, Junior thought, I'd have a major miracle to report to my dad and Reverend Coggins. He was sitting against a wall lined with shelves of canned goods. He had propped Angie on his right and Dodie on his left. Menagerie a trios, as they said in the penthouse forum. His girls hadn't looked too good with the flashlight on, their swollen faces and bulging eyes only partially obscured by their hanging hair. But once he turned it off, hey, they could have been a couple of live chicks. Except for the smell, that was. A mixture of old shit and decay just starting to happen. But it wasn't too bad because there were other more pleasant smells in here. Coffee, chocolate, molasses, dried fruit, and maybe brown sugar. Also a faint aroma of perfume. Dodie's? Angie's? He didn't know. What he knew was that his headache was better again, and that disturbing white spot had gone away. He slid his hand down and cupped Angie's breast.
You don't mind me doing that, do you, Ange? I mean, I know you're Frankie's girlfriend, but you guys sort of broke up, and hey, it's only copping a feel. Also, I hate to tell you this, but I think he's got cheating on his mind tonight.
He groped with his free hand, found one of Dodie's. It was chilly, but he put it on his crotch anyway.
Oh my, Dodes, he said. That's pretty bold. But you do what you feel, girl. Get down with your bad self.
He'd have to bury them, of course, soon. The dome was apt to pop like a soap bubble, or the scientists would find a way to dissolve it. When that happened, the town would be flooded with investigators, and if the dome stayed in place, there would likely be some sort of food-finding committee going house to house looking for supplies. Soon. But not right now. Because this was soothing. Also sort of exciting. People wouldn't understand, of course, but they wouldn't have to understand, because...
This is our secret, Junior whispered in the dark. Isn't it, girls?
They did not reply. Although they would, in time. Junior sat with his arms around the girls he had murdered, and at some point, he drifted off to sleep. 8. When Barbie and Brenda Perkins left the town hall at 11, the meeting was still going on. The two of them walked down Main to Morin without speaking much at first. There was still a small stack of the Democrat one-page extras on the corner of Main and Maple. Barbie slid one out from beneath the rock anchoring the pile. Brenda had a penlight in her purse,
and shown the beam on the headline.
Seeing it in print should make it easier to believe, but it doesn't, she said.
No, he agreed.
You and Julia collaborated on this to make sure James couldn't cover it up, she said. Isn't that so?
Barbie shook his head.
He wouldn't try because it can't be done. When that missile hits, it's going to make one hell of a bang. Julia just wanted to make sure Rennie doesn't get to spin the news his way, whatever way that might be. He tapped the one sheet. To be perfectly blunt, I see this as insurance. Selectman Rennie's got to be thinking, if he was ahead of me on this, what other information is he ahead of me on?
James Rennie can be a very dangerous adversary, my friend.
They began walking again. Brenda folded the paper and tucked it under her arm.
My husband was investigating him.
For what?
I don't know how much to tell you, she said. The choices seem to come down to all or nothing. And Howie had no absolute proof. That's one thing I do know. Although he was close.
This isn't about proof, Barbie said. It's about me staying out of jail if tomorrow doesn't go well. If what you know might help me with that.
If staying out of jail is the only thing you're worried about, I'm disappointed in you.
It wasn't all, and Barbie guessed the Widow Perkins knew it. He had listened carefully at the meeting, and although Rennie had taken pains to be at his most ingratiating and sweetly reasonable, Barbie had still been appalled. He thought that beneath the goshes and gollies and doggonets, the man was a raptor. He would exert control until it was wrested from him. He would take what he needed until he was stopped. That made him dangerous for everybody, not just for Dale Barbara.
Mrs. Perkins.
Brenda, remember?
Brenda, right.
Put it this way, Brenda. If the dome stays in place, this town is going to need help from someone other than a used car salesman with delusions of grandeur. I can't help anybody if I'm in the Calabozo.
What my husband believed is that Big Jim was helping himself.
How, to what, and how much?
She said, let's see what happens with the missile. If it doesn't work, I'll tell you everything. If it does, I'll sit down with the county attorney when the dust settles. And in the words of Ricky Ricardo, James Rennie will have some splainin' to do.
You're not the only one waiting to see what happens with the missile. Tonight, butter wouldn't melt in Rennie's mouth. If the cruise bounces off instead of punching through, I think we may see his other side.
She snapped off the penlight and looked up.
See the stars, she said. So bright. There's the Dipper. Cassiopeia. The Great Bear. All just the same. I find that comforting, do you?
Yes.
They said nothing for a little while, only looked up at the glimmering sprawl of the Milky Way. But they always make me feel very small and very, very brief.
She laughed, then said rather timidly,
would you mind if I took your arm, Bobby?
Not at all. She grasped his elbow. He put his hand over hers. Then he walked her home. 9. Big Jim adjourned the meeting at 11:20. Peter Randolph bade them all good night and left. He planned to start the evacuation on the west side of town at 7 a.m. sharp, and hoped to have the entire area around Little Bitch Road clear by noon. Andrea followed, walking slowly with her hands planted in the small of her back. It was a posture with which they had all become familiar. Although his meeting with Lester Coggins was very much on his mind, and sleep, he wouldn't mind getting a little damn sleep. Big Jim asked her if she could stay behind a moment or two. She looked at him questioningly. Behind him, Andy Sanders was ostentatiously stacking files and putting them back in the gray steel cabinet. And close the door, Big Jim said pleasantly. Now, looking worried, she did as he asked. Andy went on doing the end-of-meeting housework, but his shoulders were hunched, as if against a blow. Whatever it was Jim wanted to talk to her about, Andy knew already. And judging by his posture, it wasn't good.
What's on your mind, Jim? She asked.
Nothing serious. Which meant it was. But it did seem to me, Andrea, that you were getting pretty chummy with that Barbara fellow before the meeting.
With Brenda, too, for that matter.
Brenda, that's just...
She started to say ridiculous, but that seemed a little strong.
Just silly. I've known Brenda for 30 years...
And Mr. Barbara for 3 months, if, that is, eating a man's waffles and bacon is a basis for knowing him.
I think he's Colonel Barbara now.
Big Jim smiled. Hard to take that seriously when the closest thing he can get to a uniform is a pair of blue jeans and a t-shirt.
You saw the president's letter.
I saw something Julia Shumway could have composed in her own gosh darn computer. Isn't that right, Andy?
Right,
Andy said without turning around. He was still filing, and then refiling what he'd already filed, from the look of it. I suppose it was from the president, Big Jim said. The smile she hated was spreading on his broad, jowly face. Andrea observed with some fascination that she could see stubble on those jowls, maybe for the first time, and she understood why Jim was always so careful to shave. The stubble gave him a sinister Nixonian look.
Well?
Worry was now edging into fright. She wanted to tell Jim she'd only been being polite, but it had actually been a little more, and she guessed Jim had seen that. He saw a great deal.
Well, he is the commander-in-chief, you know.
Big Jim made a pshaw gesture. Do you know what a commander is, Andrea? I'll tell you. Someone who merits loyalty and obedience because he can provide the resources to help those in need. It's supposed to be a fair trade.
Yes, she said eagerly. Resources like that cruiser missile thing.
And if it works, that's all very fine.
How could it not? He said it might have a 1,000-pound warhead.
Considering how little we know about the dome, how can you or any of us be sure? How can we be sure it won't blow the dome up and leave nothing but a mile deep crater where Chester's Mill used to be? She looked at him in dismay, hands in the small of her back, rubbing and kneading at the place where the pain lived. Well, that's in God's hands, he said. And you're right, Andrea. It may work, but if it doesn't, we're on our own. And a commander-in-chief who can't help his citizens isn't worth a squirt of warm pee in a cold chamber pot, as far as I'm concerned. If it doesn't work, and if they don't blow all of us to glory, somebody is going to have to take hold in this town. Is it going to be some drifter the president taps with his magic wand, or is it going to be the elected officials already in place? Do you see where I'm going with this?
Colonel Barbara seemed very capable to me, she whispered.
Stop calling him that, Big Jim shouted.
Andy dropped a file, and Andrea took a step backward, uttering a squeak of fear as she did so. Then she straightened, momentarily recovering some of the Yankee steel that had given her the courage to run for selectman in the first place.
Don't you yell at me, Jim Rennie. I've known you since you were cutting out Sears catalog pictures in the first grade and pasting them on construction paper. So don't you yell.
Oh, gosh, she's offended. The fierce smile now spread from ear to ear, lifting his upper face into an unsettling mask of jollity. Isn't that too cotton-picking bad? But it's late and I'm tired and I've handed out about all the sweet syrup I can manage for one day. So you listen to me now and don't make me repeat myself. He glanced at his watch. It's 11:35 and I want to be home by midnight.
I don't understand what you want of me.
He rolled his eyes as if he couldn't believe her stupidity. In a nutshell, I want to know you're going to be on my side, mine and Andy's, if this harebrained missile idea doesn't work. Not with some dishwashing Johnny-come-lately. She squared up her shoulders and let go of her back. She managed to meet his eyes, but her lips were trembling.
And if I think Colonel Barbara, Mr. Barbara, if you prefer, is better qualified to manage things in a crisis situation?
Well, I have to go with Jiminy Cricket on that one, Big Jim said. Let your conscience be your guide. His voice had dropped to a murmur that was more frightening than his shout had been. But there's those pills you take. Those Oxycontins. Andrea felt her skin go cold.
What about them?
Andy's got a pretty good supply put aside for you, but if you were to back the wrong horse in this here race, those pills just might disappear. Isn't that right, Andy?
Andy had begun washing out the coffee maker. He looked unhappy, and he wouldn't meet Andrea's brimming eyes. But there was no hesitation in his reply.
Yes, he said. In a case like that, I might have to turn them down the pharmacist's toilet. Dangerous to have drugs like that around, with the town cut off and all.
You can't do that, she cried. I have a prescription.
Big Jim said kindly, the only prescription you need is sticking with the people who know this town best, Andrea. For the present, it's the only kind of prescription that will do you any good.
Jim, I need my pills.
She heard the whine in her voice, so much like her mother's during the last bad years when she'd been bedridden and hated it.
I need them.
I know, Big Jim said. God has burdened you with a great deal of pain. Not to mention a big old monkey on your back, he thought.
Just do the right thing, Andy said. His dark circled eyes were sad and earnest. Jim knows what's best for the town, always has. We don't need some outsider telling us our business.
If I do, will I keep getting my pain pills?
Andy's face lit in a smile.
You betcha. I might even take it on myself to up the dosage a little. Say 100 milligrams more a day. Couldn't you use it? You look awfully uncomfortable.
I suppose I could use a little more,
Andrea said dully. She lowered her head. She hadn't taken a drink, not even a glass of wine, since the night of the senior prom when she'd gotten so sick. Had never smoked a joint, had never even seen cocaine except on TV. She was a good person. A very good person. So how had she gotten into a box like this? By falling while she was going to get the mail? Was that all it took to turn someone into a drug addict? If so, how unfair. How horrible.
But only 40 milligrams. 40 more would be enough, I think.
Are you sure? Big Jim asked. She didn't feel sure at all. That was the devil of it.
Maybe 80, she said, and wiped the tears from her face. And in a whisper, you're blackmailing me.
The whisper was low, but Big Jim heard it. He reached for her. Andrea flinched, but Big Jim only took her hand. Gently.
No, he said. That would be a sin. We're helping you. And all we want in return is for you to help us.
10. There was a thud. It brought Sammy wide awake in bed, even though she'd smoked half a dube and drunk 3 of Phil's beers before falling out at 10 o'clock. She always kept a couple of 6s in the fridge and still thought of them as Phil's beers, although he'd been gone since April. She'd heard rumors that he was still in town, but discounted them. Surely if he was still around, she would have seen him sometime during the last 6 months, wouldn't she? It was a small town, just like that song said. Thud. That got her bolt upright and listening for little Walter's wail. It didn't come, and she thought, oh, God, that damn crib fell apart, and if he can't even cry. She threw the covers back and ran for the door. She smacked into the wall to the left of it instead. Almost fell down. Damn dark, damn power company. Damn Phil going off and leaving her like this. With no one to stick up for her when guys like Frank the Lesseps were mean to her and scared her and... Thud. She felt along the top of the dresser and found the flashlight. She turned it on and hurried out the door. She started to turn left into the bedroom where little Walter slept, but the thud came again. Not from the left, but from straight ahead. Across the cluttered living room. Someone was at the trailer's front door. And now there came muffled laughter. Whoever it was sounded like they had their drink on. She strode across the room, the t-shirt she slept in rippling around her chubby thighs. She'd put on a little weight since Phil left, about 50 pounds. But when this dome shit was over, she intended to get on Nutrisystem, return to her high school weight, and threw open the door. Flashlights, 4 of them, and high-powered, hit her in the face. From behind them came more laughter. One of those laughs was more of a nyuk, 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 like Curly and the Three Stooges. She recognized that one, having heard it all through high school. Mel Searles.
"Look at you," Mel said, "all dressed up and no one to blow."
More laughter. Sammy raised an arm to shield her eyes, but it did no good. The people behind the flashlights were just shapes, but one of the laughers sounded female. That was probably good.
"Turn off those lights before I go blind, and shut up, you'll wake the baby."
More laughter, louder than ever, but three of the four lights went out. She trained her own flashlight out the door and wasn't comforted by what she saw. Frankie DeLesseps and Mel Searles flanking Carter Thibodeau and Georgia Rue. Georgia, the girl who'd put her foot on Sammy's tit that afternoon and called her a dyke. A female, but not a safe female. They were wearing their badges, and they were indeed drunk.
"What do you want? It's late."
"Want some dope," Georgia said. "You sell it, so sell some to us."
"I want to get high as apple pie in a red dirt sky," Mel said, and then laughed. "Nyuk, nyuk, nyuk."
"I don't have any,"
Sammy said.
"Bullshit. The place reeks of it," Carter said. "Sell us some. Don't be a bitch."
"Yeah,"
Georgia said. And the light of Sammy's flash. Her eyes had a silvery glitter.
"Never mind that we're cops."
They all roared at this. They would wake the baby for sure.
"No."
Sammy tried to shut the door. Thibodeau pushed it open again. He did it with just the flat of his hand. Easy as could be. But Sammy went stumbling backward. She tripped over little Walter's goddamn choo-choo and went down on her ass for the second time that day. Her t-shirt flew up.
"Ooh, pink underwear. Are you expecting one of your girlfriends?"
Georgia asked, and they all roared again. The flashlights that had gone out now came back on, spotlighting her. Sammy yanked the t-shirt down almost hard enough to rip the neck. Then she got unsteadily to her feet, the flashlight beams dancing up and down her body.
"Be a good hostess and invite us in," Frankie said, barging through the door. "Thank you very much."
His light flashed around the living room.
"What a pigsty."
"Pigsty for a pig,"
Georgia bellowed, and they all broke up again.
"If I was Phil, I might come back out of the woods just long enough to kick your fucking ass."
She raised her fist. Carter Thibodeau knuckle-dapped her. "He still hiding out at the radio station?" Mel asked. "Tweaking the rock? Getting all paranoid for Jesus?"
"I don't know what you..."
She wasn't mad anymore, only afraid. This was the disconnected way people talked in the nightmares that came if you smoke weed dusted with PCP.
"Phil's gone."
Her four visitors looked at each other, then laughed. Searle's idiotic nyuk, nyuk, nyuk rode above the others.
"Gone. Bugged out," Frankie crowed.
"Fucking as if,"
Carter replied. And then they bumped knucks. Georgia grabbed a bunch of Sammy's paperbacks off the top shelf of the bookcase and looked through them.
"Nora Roberts, Sandra Brown, Stephanie Meyer. You read this stuff? Don't you know fucking Harry Potter rules?"
She held the books out, then opened her hands and dropped them on the floor. The baby still hadn't awakened. It was a miracle.
"If I sell you some dope, will you go?"
Sammy asked.
"Sure," Frankie said.
"And hurry up," Carter said. "We got an early call tomorrow. Evacuation details, so shag that fat ass of yours."
"Wait here."
She went into the kitchenette and opened the freezer. Warm now. Everything would be thawed for some reason that made her feel like crying. And took out one of the gallon baggies of dope she kept in there. There were three others. She started to turn around, but someone grabbed her before she could, and someone else plucked the baggie from her hand.
"I want to check out that pink underwear again," Mel said in her ear. "See if you got Sunday on your ass."
He yanked her shirt up to her waist.
"Nope, guess not."
"Stop it, quit it."
Mel laughed.
"Nyuk, nyuk, nyuk."
A flashlight stabbed her in the eyes, but she recognized the narrow head behind it. Frankie DeLesseps.
"You gave me lip today," he said. "Plus, you slapped me and hurt my little Hanny. And all I did was this."
He reached out and grabbed her breast again.
She tried to jerk away. The beam of light that had been trained on her face tilted momentarily up to the ceiling, then it came down again fast. Pain exploded in her head. He had hit her with his flashlight.
Ow, ow, that hurts, stop it.
Shit, that didn't hurt. You're just lucky I don't arrest you for pushing dope. Stand still if you don't want another one. This dope smells skanky, Mel said in a matter-of-fact voice.
He was behind her, still holding up her shirt.
So does she, Georgia said. Gotta confiscate the weed, biatch, Carter said. Sorry.
Frankie had glommed onto her breast again. Stand still, he pinched the nipple. Just stand still. His voice roughening, his breathing quickening. She knew where this was going. She closed her eyes. Just as long as the baby doesn't wake up, she thought. And as long as they don't do more. Do worse.
Go on, Georgia said. Show her what she's been missing since Phil left.
Frankie gestured into the living room with his flashlight. Get on the couch and spread 'em.
Do you want to read her rights first? Mel asked and laughed.
Nyuk, nyuk, nyuk.
Sammy thought if she had to hear that laugh one more time, her head would split wide open. But she started for the couch, head down, shoulders slumped. Carter grabbed her on the way by, turned her, and sprayed the beam of his flashlight up his own face, turning it into a goblin mask.
Are you going to talk about this, Sammy?
No.
The goblin mask nodded.
You hold that thought. Because no one would believe you anyway. Except for us, of course, and then we'd have to come back and really fuck you up.
Frankie pushed her onto the couch.
Do her, Georgia said excitedly, training her light on Sammy. Do that bitch.
All three of the young men did her. Frankie went first, whispering.
You gotta learn to keep your mouth shut except for when you're on your knees, as he pushed into her.
Carter was next. While he was riding her, little Walter awoke and began to cry.
Shut up, kid, or I'll have to read you your rights,
Mel Searles hollered, and then laughed. Nyuk, nyuk, nyuk. 11. It was almost midnight. Linda Everett lay fast asleep in her half of the bed. She had an exhausting day. She had an early call tomorrow, evacuation detail, and not even her worries about Janelle could keep her awake. She didn't snore, exactly, but a soft queep, queep, queep sound came from her half of the bed. Rusty had had an equally exhausting day, but he couldn't sleep, and it wasn't Jan he was worried about. He thought she was going to be all right, at least for a while. He could keep her seizures at bay if they didn't get any worse. If he ran out of Zorontin at the hospital dispensary, he could get more from Sander's drug. It was Dr. Haskell he kept thinking about. And Rory Dinsmore, of course. Rusty kept seeing the torn and bloody socket where the boy's eye had been. Kept hearing Ron Haskell telling Ginny, I'm not death. Deaf, I mean. Except he had been death. He rolled over in bed, trying to leave these memories behind, and what came in their place was Rory muttering, it's Halloween. Overlapping that, his own daughter's voice, it's the Great Pumpkin's fault, you have to stop the Great Pumpkin. His daughter had been having a seizure, the Dinsmore kid had taken a ricochet to the eye and a bullet fragment to the brain. What did that tell him? It tells me nothing. What did the Scottish guy say on Lost? Don't mistake coincidence for fate? Maybe that had been it. Maybe it had, but Lost had been a long time ago. The Scottish guy could have said, don't mistake fate for coincidence. He rolled over the other way and this time saw the black headline of that night's Democrat one sheet. Explosives to be fired at barrier. It was hopeless. Sleep was out of the question for now. And the worst thing you could do in a situation like that was try to flog your way into dreamland. There was half a loaf of Linda's famous cranberry orange bread downstairs. He'd seen it on the counter when he came in. Rusty decided he'd have a piece of it at the kitchen table and thumb through the latest issue of American Family Physician. If an article on whooping cough wouldn't put him to sleep, nothing would. He got up, a big man dressed in the blue scrubs that were his usual nightwear, and left quietly, so as not to wake Linda. Halfway to the stairs, he paused and cocked his head. Audrey was whining, very soft and low. From the girls' room. Rusky went down there and eased the door open. The golden retriever, just a dim shape between the girls' beds, turned to look at him and voiced another of those low whines. Judy was lying on her side, with one hand tucked under her cheek, breathing long and slow. Janny was a different story. She rolled restlessly from one side to the other, kicking at the bedclothes and muttering. Rusty stepped over the dog and sat down on her bed, under Janny's latest boy band poster. She was dreaming, not a good dream by her troubled expression, and that muttering sounded like protests. Rusty tried to make out the words, but before he could, she ceased. Audrey whined again. Jan's nightdress was all twisted. Rusty straightened it, pulled up the covers, and brushed Janny's hair off her forehead. Her eyes were moving rapidly back and forth beneath her closed lids, but he observed no trembling of the limbs, no fluttering fingers, no characteristic smacking of the lips. REM sleep rather than seizure, almost certainly. Which raised an interesting question. Could dogs also smell bad dreams? He bent and kissed Jan's cheek. When he did, her eyes opened, but he wasn't entirely sure she was seeing him. This could have been a Pettymal symptom, but Rusty just didn't believe it. Audie would have been barking, he felt sure. "Go back to sleep, honey," he said.
"He has a golden baseball, Daddy."
"I know he does, honey. Go back to sleep."
"It's a bad baseball."
"No. It's good. Baseballs are good, especially golden ones."
"Oh,"
she said. "Go back to sleep."
"Okay, Daddy."
She rolled over and closed her eyes. There was a moment of settling beneath the covers, and then she was still. Audrey, who had been lying on the floor with her head up watching them, now put her muzzle on her paw and went to sleep herself. Rusty sat there a while, listening to his daughter's breathe, telling himself there was really nothing to be frightened of. People talk their way in and out of dreams all the time. He told himself that everything was fine. He only had to look at the sleeping dog on the floor if he doubted. But in the middle of the night, it was hard to be an optimist. When dawn was still long hours away, bad thoughts took on flesh and began to walk. In the middle of the night, thoughts became zombies. He decided he didn't want the cranberry orange bread after all. What he wanted was to snuggle against his bed-warm sleeping wife. But before leaving the room, he stroked Audrey's silky head. "Pay attention, girl," he whispered. Audie briefly opened her eyes and looked at him. He thought, golden retriever. And following that, the perfect connection. Golden baseball. A bad baseball. That night, despite of the girls' newly discovered feminine privacy, Rusty left their door open. 12. Lester Coggins was sitting on Rennie's stoop when Big Jim got back. Coggins was reading his Bible by flashlight. This did not inspire Big Jim with the reverence devotion, but only worsened a mood that was already bad.
"God bless you, Jim,"
Coggins said, standing up. When Big Jim offered his hand, Coggins seized it in a fervent fist and pumped it.
"Bless you, too," Big Jim said gamely.
Coggins gave his hand a final hard shake and let go.
"Jim, I'm here because I've had a revelation. I asked for one last night, yea, for I was sorely troubled, and this afternoon it came. God has spoken to me, both through the scripture and through that young boy."
"The Dinsmore kid?"
Coggins kissed his clasped hands with a loud smack, and then held them skyward. "The very same. Rory Dinsmore. May God keep him for all eternity."
"He's eating dinner with Jesus right this minute," Big Jim said automatically.
He was examining the Reverend in the beam of his own flashlight, and what he was seeing wasn't good. Although the night was cooling rapidly, sweat shone on Coggins' skin. His eyes were wide, showing too much of the whites. His hair stood out in wild curls and bumper shoots. All in all, he looked like a fellow whose gears were slipping, and might soon be stripping. Big Jim thought, this is not good.
"Yes," Coggins said, "I'm sure, eating the great feast, wrapped in the everlasting arms."
Big Jim thought it would be hard to do both things at the same time, but kept silent on that score.
"And yet his death was for a purpose, Jim.
That's what I've come to tell you.
Tell me inside, Big Jim said, and before the minister could reply, have you seen my son?
Junior? No.
How long have you been here?
Big Jim flicked on the hall light, blessing the generator as he did so. An hour, maybe a little less, sitting on the steps, reading, praying, meditating.
Rennie wondered if anyone had seen him, but did not ask. Coggins was upset already, and a question like that might upset him more. Well, let's go in my study, he said, and led the way, head down, lumbering slowly along in his big, flat strides. Seen from behind, he looked a bit like a bear dressed in human clothes, one who was old and slow, but still dangerous. 13. In addition to the picture of the Sermon on the Mount with his safe behind it, there were a great many plaques on the walls of Big Jim's study, commending him for various acts of community service. There was also a framed picture of Big Jim shaking hands with Sarah Palin, and another of him shaking with the big number three, Dale Earnhardt, when Earnhardt had done a fundraiser for some children's charity at the annual Oxford Plains Crasherama. There was even a picture of Big Jim shaking hands with Tiger Woods, who had seemed like a very nice Negro. The only piece of memorabilia on his desk was a gold-plated baseball in a lucite cradle. Below it, also in lucite, was an autograph reading, "To Jim Rennie, with thanks for your help in putting on the Western Maine Charity Softball Tournament of 2007. It was signed Bill Spaceman Lee. As he sat behind his desk in his high-backed chair, Big Jim took the ball from its cradle and began tossing it from hand to hand. It was a fine thing to toss, especially when you were a little upset. Nice and heavy, the golden seams smacking comfortably against your palms. Big Jim sometimes wondered what it would be like to have a solid gold ball. Perhaps he would look into that when this dome business was over. Coggins seated himself on the other side of the desk, in the client's chair, the supplicant's chair, which was where Big Jim wanted him. The reverend's eyes went back and forth, like the eyes of a man watching a tennis match, or maybe a hypnotist's crystal. Now, what's this all about, Lester? Fill me in, but let's keep it short, shall we? I need to get some sleep. Got a lot to do tomorrow.
Will you pray with me first, Jim?
Big Jim smiled. It was the fierce one, although not turned up to maximum chill. At least, not yet. Why don't you fill me in before we do that? I like to know what I'm praying about before I get knee-bound.
Lester did not keep it short, but Big Jim hardly noticed. He listened with growing dismay that was close to horror. The reverend's narrative was disjointed and peppered with biblical quotations, but the gist was clear. He had decided that their little business had displeased the Lord enough for him to clap a big glass bowl over the whole town. Lester had prayed on what to do about this, scourging himself as he did so. The scourging might have been metaphorical, Big Jim certainly hoped so. And the Lord had led him to some Bible verse about madness, blindness, smiting, etc., etc.
The Lord said he would shew me a sign and...
Shew? Big Jim raised his tufted eyebrows. Lester ignored him and plunged on, sweating like a man with malaria, his eyes still following the golden ball, back and forth.
It was like when I was a teenager, and I used to come in my bed.
Les, that's a little too much information. Tossing the ball from hand to hand.
God said he would shew me blindness, but not my blindness. And this afternoon, out in that field, he did. Didn't he?
Well, I guess that's one interpretation.
No!
Coggins leaped to his feet. He began to walk in a circle on the rug, his Bible in one hand. With the other, he tugged at his hair.
God said that when I saw that sign, I had to tell my congregation exactly what you'd been up to.
Just me? Big Jim asked. He did so in a meditative voice. He was tossing the ball from hand to hand. A little faster now. Smack, 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 back and forth against palms that were fleshy, but still hard.
No,
Lester said in a kind of groan.
He paced faster now, no longer looking at the ball. He was waving the Bible with the hand not busy trying to tear his hair out by the roots. He did the same thing in the pulpit sometimes when he really got going. That stuff was all right in church, but here, it was just plain infuriating. It was you and me and Roger Killian, the Bowie brothers, and, he lowered his voice, and that other one, the chef. I think that man's crazy. If he wasn't when he started last spring, he sure is now. Look who's talking, little buddy, Big Jim thought. We're all involved, but it's you and I who have to confess, Jim. That's what the Lord told me. That's what the boy's blindness meant, is what he died for. We'll confess, and we'll burn that barn of Satan behind the church. Then God will let us go. You'll go, all right, Lester, straight to Shawshank State Prison. I will take the punishment God metes out, and gladly. And me, Andy Sanders, the Bowie brothers, and Roger Killian. He's got, I think, 9 kids to support. What if we're not so glad, Lester? I can't help that. Now Lester began to whack himself on the shoulders with his Bible back and forth, first one side and then the other. Big Jim found himself synchronizing his tosses of the golden baseball to the preacher's blows. Whack and smack. Whack and smack. Whack and smack. It's sad about the Killian children, of course, but Exodus 20, verse 5. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the 3rd and 4th generation. We have to bow to that. We have to clean out this chancre, however much it may hurt. Make right what we have made wrong. That means confession and purification. Purification by fire. Big Jim raised the hand not currently holding the gold baseball. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Think about what you're saying. This town depends on me, and you, of course, in ordinary times, but in times of crisis it needs us. He stood up, pushing his chair back. This had been a long and terrible day. He was tired, and now this. It made a man angry. We have sinned. Coggins spoke stubbornly, still whacking himself with his Bible, as if he thought treating God's holy book like that was perfectly okay. What we did, Les, was keep thousands of kids from starving in Africa. We even paid to treat their hellish diseases. We also built you a new church and the most powerful Christian radio station in the Northeast. And lined our own pockets, don't forget that. Coggins shrilled. This time he smacked himself full in the face with the good book. A thread of blood seeped from one nostril. Lined them with filthy dope money. He smacked himself again. And Jesus' radio station is being run by a lunatic who cooks the poison that children put into their veins. Actually, I think most of them smoke it. Is that supposed to be funny? Big Jim came around the desk. His temples were throbbing and a brick-like flush was rising in his cheeks. Yet he tried once more, speaking softly, as if to a child doing a tantrum. Lester, the town needs my leadership. If you go opening your gob, I won't be able to provide that leadership. Not that anyone will believe you. They'll all believe, Coggins cried. When they see the devil's workshop I've let you run behind my church, they'll all believe. And Jim, don't you see, once the sin is out, once the soul's been cleansed, God will remove his barrier. The crisis will end. They won't need your leadership. That was when James P. Rennie snapped. They'll always need it, he roared, and swung the baseball in his closed fist. It split the skin of Lester's left temple as Lester was turning to face him. Blood poured down the side of Lester's face. His left eye glared out of the gore. He lurched forward with his hands out. The Bible flapped at Big Jim like a blabbery mouth. Blood pattered down onto the carpet. The left shoulder of Lester's sweater was already soaked.
No, this is not the will of the Lord.
It's my will, you troublesome fly. Big Jim swung again, and this time connected with the Reverend's forehead, dead center. Big Jim felt the shock travel all the way up to his shoulder. Yet Lester staggered forward, wagging his Bible. It seemed to be trying to talk.
Big Jim dropped the ball to his side. His shoulder was throbbing. Now blood was pouring onto the carpet. And still the son of a buck wouldn't go down. Still he came forward, trying to talk, and spitting scarlet in a fine spray. Coggins bumped into the front of the desk. Blood splattered across the previously unmarked blotter, and then began to sidle along it. Big Jim tried to raise the ball again, and couldn't. I knew all that high school shot putting would catch up with me someday, he thought. He switched the ball to his left hand and swung it sideways and upward. It connected with Lester's jaw, knocking his lower face out of true and spraying more blood into the not-quite-steady light of the overhead fixture. A few drops struck the milky glass.
Gah!
Lester cried. He was still trying to sidle around the desk. Big Jim retreated into the knee hole.
Dad?
Junior was standing in the doorway, eyes wide, mouth open.
Gah!
Lester said, and began to flounder around toward the new voice. He held out the Bible.
God!
Don't just stand there, help me! Big Jim roared at his son.
Lester began to stagger toward Junior, flapping the Bible extravagantly up and down. His sweater was sodden, his pants had turned a muddy maroon, his face was gone, buried in blood. Junior hurried to meet him. When Lester started to collapse, Junior grabbed him and held him up.
I got you, Reverend Coggins, I got you, don't worry.
Then Junior clamped his hands around Lester's blood-sticky throat and began to squeeze. 14. 5 interminable minutes later. Big Jim sat in his office chair, sprawled in his office chair, with his tie put on special for the meeting, pulled down and his shirt unbuttoned. He was massaging his hefty left breast. Beneath it, his heart was still galloping and throwing off arrhythmias, but showed no signs of actually going into cardiac arrest. Junior left. Rennie thought at first he was going to get Randolph, which would have been a mistake, but he was too breathless to call the boy back. Then he came back on his own, carrying the tarp from the back of the camper. He watched Junior shake it out on the floor, oddly businesslike, as if he'd done this 1,000 times before. It's all those R-rated movies they watch now, Big Jim thought, rubbing the flabby flesh that had once been so firm and so hard.
I'll help,
he wheezed, knowing he could not.
You'll sit right there and get your breath.
His son on his knees gave him a dark and unreadable look. There might have been love in it. Big Jim certainly hoped there was, but there were other things, too.
Gotcha now. Was gotcha now part of that look?
Junior rolled Lester onto the tarp. The tarp crackled. Junior studied the body, rolled it a little farther, then flipped the end of the tarp over it. The tarp was green. Big Jim had bought it at Burpee's, bought it on sale. He remembered Toby Manning saying, "You're getting a heck of a good deal on that one, Mr. Rennie."
"Bible,"
Big Jim said. He was still wheezing, but he felt a little better. Heartbeat slowing, thank God. Who knew the climb would get so steep after 50? He thought, I have to start working out. Get back in shape. God only gives you one body. Right, yeah, good call, Junior murmured. He grabbed the bloody Bible, wedged it between Coggins' thighs, and began rolling up the body.
He broke in, son. He was crazy. Sure.
Junior did not seem interested in that. What he seemed interested in was rolling the body up, just so.
It was him or me. You'll have to...
Another little taradiddle in his chest. Jim gasped, coughed, pounded his breast. His heart settled again.
You'll have to take him out to Holy Redeemer. When he's found, there's a guy, maybe...
It was the chef he was thinking of, but maybe arranging for Chef to carry the can for this was a bad idea. Chef Bushy knew stuff. Of course, he'd probably resist arrest. In which case, he might not be taken alive.
I've got a better place, Junior said.
He sounded serene.
And if you're talking about hanging it on someone, I've got a better idea.
Who?
Dale fucking Barbara. You know I don't approve of that language.
Looking at him over the tarp, eyes glittering, Junior said it again.
Dale fucking Barbara. How? I don't know yet, but you better wash off that damn gold ball if you mean to keep it. And get rid of the blotter.
Big Jim got to his feet. He was feeling better now.
You're a good boy to help your old dad this way, Junior.
If you say so, Junior replied. There was now a big green burrito on the rug, with feet sticking out the end. Junior tucked the tarp over them, but it wouldn't stay.
I'll need some duct tape. If you're not going to take him to the church, then where...
Never mind, Junior said. It's safe. The Rev will keep until we figure out how to put Barbara in the frame.
Got to see what happens tomorrow before we do anything.
Junior looked at him with an expression of distant contempt Big Jim had never seen before. It came to him that his son now had a great deal of power over him. But surely his own son.
We'll have to bury your rug. Thank God it's not the wall-to-wall carpet you used to have in here. And the upside is it caught most of the mess.
Then he lifted the big burrito and bore it down the hall. A few minutes later, Rennie heard the camper start up. Big Jim considered the golden baseball.
I should get rid of that, too, he thought. I knew he wouldn't. It was practically a family heirloom. And besides, what harm if it was clean?
When Junior returned an hour later, the golden baseball was once again gleaming in its lucite cradle. Missile strike imminent. 1.
Attention, this is the Chester's Mill police. The area is being evacuated. If you hear me, come to the sound of my voice. The area is being evacuated.
Thurston Marshall and Carolyn Sturges sat up in bed, listening to this weird blare and looking at each other with wide eyes. They were teachers at Emerson College in Boston. Thurston, a full professor of English and guest editor for the current issue of Plowshares. Carolyn, a graduate assistant in the same department. They had been lovers for the last 6 months, and the bloom was far from off the rose. They were in Thurston's little cabin on Chester Pond, which lay between Little Bitch Road and Presteel Stream. They had come here for a long fall foliage weekend, but most of the foliage they had admired since Friday afternoon had been of the pubic variety. There was no TV in the cabin. Thurston Marshall abominated TV. There was a radio, but they hadn't turned it on. It was 8:30 in the morning on Monday, October 23rd. Neither of them had any idea anything was wrong until that blaring voice startled them awake.
Attention, this is the Chester's Mill police. The area...
Closer. Moving in.
Thurston. The dope. Where did you leave the dope?
Don't worry, he said.
But the quaver in his voice suggested he was incapable of taking his own advice. He was a tall, reedy man with a lot of graying hair that he usually tied back in a ponytail. Now it lay loose, almost to his shoulders. He was 60. Carolyn was 23.
All these little camps are deserted at this time of year. They'll just drive past and back to the little bitch.
She pounded him on the shoulder. A first.
The car is in the driveway. They'll see the car.
An oh-shit look dawned on his face.
Evacuated. If you hear me, come to the sound of my voice. Attention. Attention.
Very close now. Thurston could hear other amplified voices as well. People using loudhailers. Cops using loudhailers. But this one was almost on top of them.
The area is being evac...
There was a moment of silence. Then,
hello, cabin. Come out here. Move it.
Oh, this was a nightmare.
Where did you leave the dope?
She pounded him again. The dope was in the other room, in a baggie that was now half empty, sitting beside a platter of last night's cheese and crackers. If someone came in, it would be the first goddamn thing they saw.
This is the police. We are not screwing around here. The area is being evacuated. If you're in there, come out before we have to drag you out.
Pigs,
he thought. Small-town pigs with small-town piggy minds. Thurston sprang from the bed and ran across the room, hair flying, skinny buttocks flexing. His grandfather had built the cabin after World War II, and it had only two rooms. A big bedroom facing the pond, and the living room kitchen. Power was provided by an old Henske generator, which Thurston had turned off before they had retired. Its ragged blat was not exactly romantic. The embers of last night's fire, not really necessary, but très romantic, still winked sleepily in the fireplace. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe I put the dope back in my attaché. Unfortunately, no. The dope was there, right next to the remains of the brie they had gorged on before commencing last night's fuckathon. He ran to it, and there was a knock on the door. No, a hammering on the door. "Just a minute," Thurston cried, madly merry. Carolyn was standing in the bedroom doorway, wrapped in a sheet, but he hardly noticed her. Thurston's mind, still suffering residual paranoia from the previous evening's indulgences, tumbled with unconnected thoughts. Revoked tenure, 1984 thought police, revoked tenure, the disgusted reaction of his three children by two previous wives, and, of course, revoked tenure. "Just a minute, just a sec, let me get dressed." But the door burst open, and, in direct violation of about 9 different constitutional guarantees, 2 young men strode in. One held a bullhorn. Both were dressed in jeans and blue shirts. The jeans were almost comforting, but the shirts bore shoulder patches and badges. "We don't need no stinking badges," Thurston thought numbly. Carolyn shrieked, "Get out of here!" "Check it out, Junes," Frankie de Lesseps said. "It's when horny met slutty." Thurston snatched up the baggie, held it behind his back, and dropped it into the sink. Junior was eyeing the equipment this move revealed. "That's about the longest and skinniest dorkola I've ever seen," he said. He looked tired, and he came by the look honestly. He'd had only 2 hours sleep, but he was feeling fine, absolutely ripping, old bean. Not a trace of a headache. This work suited him. "Get out!" Carolyn shouted. Frankie said, "You want to shut your mouth, sweetheart, and put on some clothes. Everyone on this side of town's being evacuated." "This is our place. Get the fuck out!" Frankie had been smiling. Now he stopped. He strode past the skinny naked man standing by the sink. Quailing by the sink might have been more accurate. And grabbed Carolyn by the shoulders. He gave her a brisk shake. "Don't give me lips, sweetheart. I'm trying to keep you from getting your ass fried. You and your boyfriend... Get your hands off me! You'll go to jail for this! My father's a lawyer!" She tried to slap him. Frankie, not a morning person, never had been, seized her hand and bent it back. Not really hard, but Carolyn screamed. The sheet dropped to the floor.
"Whoa! That's a serious rack," Junior confided to the gaping Thurston Marshall. "Can you keep up with that, old fella?"
"Get your clothes on, both of you," Frankie said. "I don't know how dumb you are, but pretty dumb would be my guess since you're still here. Don't you know..." He stopped, looked from the woman's face to the man's, both equally terrified, equally mystified.
"Junior," he said.
"What?"
"Titsy McGee and Wrinkle Boy don't know what's going on."
"Don't you dare call me any of your sexist..." Junior held up his hands. "Ma'am, get dressed. You have to get out of here. The U.S. Air Force is going to fire a cruise missile at this part of town in..." He looked at his watch. "A little less than 5 hours.
"Are you insane?" Carolyn screamed.
Junior heaved a sigh and then pushed ahead. He guessed he understood the whole cop thing a little better now. It was a great job, but people could be so stupid. If it bounces off, you'd just hear a big bang. Might cause you to shit your pants, if you were wearing any. But it wouldn't hurt you. If it punches through, though, you'd most likely get charbroiled, since it's going to be really big, and you're less than 2 miles from what they say is going to be the point of impact.
"Bounces off what, you dimwit?" Thurston demanded.
With the dope in the sink, he now used one hand to cover his privates. Or at least he tried to. His love machine was indeed extremely long and skinny.
"The dome," Frankie said, "and I don't appreciate your mouth."
He took a long step forward and punched the current guest editor of Plowshares in the gut.
Thurston made a hoarse woofing sound, doubled over, staggered, almost kept his feet, went to his knees, and vomited up about a teacup's worth of thin white gruel that still smelled of brie. Carolyn held her swelling wrist.
"You'll go to jail for this,"
she promised Junior in a low, trembling voice.
"Bush and Cheney are long gone. This isn't the United States of North Korea anymore."
"I know that," Junior said, with admirable patience for one who was thinking he wouldn't mind doing a little more choking. There was a small, dark Gila monster in his brain that thought a little more choking would be just the way to start the day off right. But no, no. He had to do his part in completing the evacuation. He had taken the oath of duty, or whatever the fuck it was. "I do know it," he repeated. "But what you two massholes don't get is that you aren't in the United States of America anymore, either. You're in the Kingdom of Chester now, and if you don't behave, you're going to end up in the dungeons of Chester. I promise. No phone call. No lawyer. No due process. We're trying to save your lives here. Are you too fucked dumb to understand that?"
She was staring at him, stunned. Thurston tried to get up, couldn't manage it, and crawled toward her. Frankie helped him along, with a boot to the butt. Thurston cried out in shock and pain. "That's for holding us up, Grandpa," Frankie said. "I admire your taste in chicks, but we got a lot to do." Junior looked at the young woman. Great mouth. Angelina lips. He bet she could, as the saying went, suck the chrome off a trailer hitch.
"If he can't get dressed by himself, you help him. We've got 4 more cabins to check out, and when we get back here, you want to be in that Volvo of yours and on your way into town."
"I don't understand any of this," Carolyn wailed.
"Not surprised," Frankie said, and plucked the baggie of dope out of the sink. "Didn't you know this stuff makes you stupid?" She began to cry.
"Don't worry," Frankie said. "I'm confiscating it, and in a couple of days, booyah, you'll smarten up all on your own."
"You didn't read us our rights," she wept.
Junior looked astonished. Then he laughed.
"You have the right to get the fuck out of here and shut the fuck up, okay? In this situation, those are the only rights you have. Do you understand that?"
Frankie was examining the confiscated dope.
"Junior," he said, "there's hardly any seeds in this. This is fucking primo."
Thurston had reached Carolyn. He got to his feet, farting quite loudly as he did so. Junior and Frankie looked at each other. They tried to hold it in. They were officers of the law, after all, and couldn't. They burst out laughing simultaneously.
"Trombone Charlie is back in town," Frankie yelled, and they gave each other a high five.
Thurston and Carolyn stood in the bedroom doorway, covering their mutual nakedness in an embrace, staring at the cackling intruders. In the background, like voices in a bad dream, loud hailers continued to announce that the area was being evacuated. Most of the amplified voices were now retreating toward Little Bitch.
"I want that car gone when we get back," Junior said, "or I will fuck you up."
They left. Carolyn dressed herself, then helped Thurston. His stomach hurt too much for him to bend over and put on his own shoes. By the time they were finished, both of them were crying. In the car, on their way back down the camp lane that led to Little Bitch Road, Carolyn tried to reach her father on her cell. She got nothing but silence. At the intersection of Little Bitch and Route 119, a town police car was pulled across the road. A stocky female cop with red hair pointed at the soft shoulder, then waved at them to use it. Carolyn pulled over instead and got out. She held up her puffy wrist.
"We were assaulted by 2 guys calling themselves cops, one named Junior and one named Frankie. They..." "Get your ass gone or I'll assault you myself," Georgia Rue said. "I ain't shittin', honey pie."
Carolyn stared at her, stunned. The whole world had turned sideways and slipped into a Twilight Zone episode while she was asleep. That had to be it. No other explanation made even marginal sense. They'd hear the Rod Serling voiceover any time now. She got back into the Volvo, the sticker on the bumper faded but still readable, Obama 12, yes, we still can, and detoured around the police car. Another, older cop was sitting inside it, going over a checklist on a clipboard. She thought of appealing to him, then thought better of it.
"Try the radio," she said. "Let's find out if something really is going on."
Thurston turned it on and got nothing but Elvis Presley and the Jordanaires trudging through How Great Thou Art.
Carolyn snapped it off, thought of saying the nightmare is officially complete, and didn't. All she wanted was to get out of Weirdsville as soon as possible. 2. On the map, the Chester Pond Camp Road was a thin hook-like thread, almost not there. After leaving the Marshall cabin, Junior and Frankie sat for a moment in Frankie's car, studying this. "Can't be anybody else down there," Frankie said. "Not at this time of the year. What do you think? Say fuck it and go back to town?" He cocked a thumb at the cabin. "They'll be along, and if they're not, who really gives a shit?" Junior considered it for a moment, then shook his head. They had taken the oath of duty. Besides, he wasn't anxious to get back and face his father's pestering about what he'd done with the Reverend's body. Coggins was now keeping his girlfriend's company in the McCain pantry, but there was no need for his dad to know that. At least not until the big man figured out how to nail Barbara with it. And Junior believed his father would figure it out. If there was one thing Big Jim Rennie was good at, it was nailing people. "Now it doesn't even matter if he finds out I left school," Junior thought, "because I know worse about him. Way worse." Not that dropping out seemed very important now. It was chump change compared to what was going on in the mill. But he'd have to be careful just the same. Junior wouldn't put it past his father to nail him if the situation seemed to call for it. "Junior, Earth to Junior." "I'm here," he said, a little irritated. "Back to town?" "Let's check out the other cabins. It's only a quarter of a mile, and if we go back to town, Randolph will find something else for us to do." "Wouldn't mind a little chow, though." "Where, at Sweetbriar? Want some rat poison in your scrambled eggs, courtesy of Dale Barbera?" "He wouldn't dare." "You positive?" "Okay, okay." Frankie started the car and backed down the little stub of driveway. The brightly colored leaves hung moveless on the trees, and the air felt sultry, more like July than October. "But the mass holes better be gone when we come back, or I just might have to introduce Titsy McGee to my helmeted avenger." "I'll be happy to hold her down," Junior said. "Yippee-ki-yi-yay, motherfucker." 3. The first three cabins were clearly empty. They didn't even bother getting out of the car. By now, the camp road was down to a pair of wheel ruts with a grassy hump between them. Trees overhung it on both sides, some of the lower branches almost close enough to scrape the roof. "I think the last one's just around this curve," Frankie said. "The road ends at this shit-pot little boat land." "Look out!" Junior shouted. They came out of the blind curve, and two kids, a boy and a girl, were standing in the road. They made no effort to get out of the way. Their faces were shocked and blank. If Frankie hadn't been afraid of tearing the Toyota's exhaust system out on the camp road center hump, if he'd been making any kind of speed at all, he would have hit them. Instead, he stood on the brake, and the car stopped 2 feet short. "Oh my God, that was close," he said. "I think I'm having a heart attack." "If my father didn't, you won't," Junior said. "Huh?" "Never mind." Junior got out. The kids were still standing there. The girl was taller and older, maybe 9. The boy looked about 5. Their faces were pale and dirty. She was holding his hand. She looked up at Junior, but the boy looked straight ahead, as if examining something of interest in the Toyota driver's side headlamp. Junior saw the terror on her face and dropped to one knee in front of her. "Honey, are you okay?" It was the boy who answered. He spoke while still examining the headlamp.
"I want my mother, and I want my breakfast."
Frankie joined him.
"Are they real?"
Speaking in a voice that said, "I'm joking, but not really." He reached out and touched the girl's arm. She jumped a little and looked at him.
"Mama didn't come back."
She spoke in a low voice.
"What's your name, hon?" Junior asked. "And who's your mommy?" "I'm Alice Rachel Appleton," she said. "This is Aiden Patrick Appleton. Our mother is Vera Appleton. Our father is Edward Appleton, but he and Mommy got a divorce last year, and now he lives in Plano, Texas. We live in Weston, Massachusetts, at 16 Oak Way. Our telephone number is..."
She recited it with the toneless accuracy of a directory assistant's recording.
Junior thought, oh, boy, more mass holes. But it made sense. Who else would burn expensive gasoline just to watch the fucking leaves fall off the fucking trees? Frankie was also kneeling now. Alice, he said, listen to me, sweetheart. Where is your mother now?
Don't know.
Tears, big, clear globes, began to roll down her cheeks.
We came to see the leaves. Also, we were going to go in the kayak. We like the kayak, don't we, Aid? I'm hungry,
Aiden said mournfully. And then he too began to cry. Seeing them like that made Junior feel like crying himself. He reminded himself he was a cop. Cops didn't cry, at least not on duty. He asked the girl again where her mother was, but it was the little boy who answered.
She went to get whoops.
He means whoopie pies, Alice said. But she went to get other stuff, too, because Mr. Killian didn't care take the cabin like he was supposed to. Mommy said I could take care of Aiden because I'm a big girl now, and she'd be right back. She was only going to Yoder's. She just said don't let Aid go near the pond.
Junior was starting to get the picture. Apparently the woman had expected to find the cabin stocked with food, a few staples at least. But if she'd known Roger Killian well, she would have known better than to depend on him. The man was a Class A dumbbell, and had passed his less-than-sterling intellect onto his entire brood. Yoder's was a nasty little store just across the Tarker's Mills town line, specializing in beer, coffee brandy, and canned spaghetti. Ordinarily, it would have been a 20-minute run there and another 20 back. Only she hadn't come back, and Junior knew why. "Did she go Saturday morning?" he asked. "She did, didn't she?"
"I want her," Aiden cried, "and I want my breakfast. My belly hurts."
"Yes," the girl said. "Saturday morning, we were watching cartoons, only now we can't watch anything because the electricity's broke."
Junior and Frankie looked at each other. Two nights alone in the dark. The girl maybe 9, the boy about 5. Junior didn't like to think about that.
"Did you have anything to eat?" Frankie asked Alice Appleton. "Sweetheart, anything at all?"
"There was an onion in the vegetable drawer," she whispered. "We each had half, with sugar."
"Oh, fuck," Frankie said. Then, "I didn't say that. You didn't hear me say that. Just a second."
He went back to the car, opened the passenger door, and began to rummage in the glove compartment.
"Where were you going, Alice?" Junior asked.
"To town, to look for Mommy and to find something to eat. We were going to walk past the next camp and then cut through the woods."
She pointed vaguely north.
"I thought that would be quicker."
Junior smiled, but he was cold inside. She wasn't pointing toward Chester's Mill. She was pointing in the direction of TR-90, at nothing but miles of tangled second growth and boggy sumps. Plus the dome, of course. Out there, Alice and Aiden would almost certainly have died of starvation. Hansel and Gretel minus the happy ending. And we came so close to turning around, Jesus. Frankie had returned. He had a Milky Way. It looked old and squashed, but it was still in the wrapper. The way the children fixed their eyes on it made Junior think of the kids you saw in the news sometimes. That look on American faces was unreal, horrible.
"It was all I could find," Frankie said, stripping off the wrapper. "We'll get you something better in town."
He broke the Milky Way in two and gave a piece to each child. The candy was gone in 5 seconds. When he had finished his piece, the boy stuck his fingers knuckle-deep into his mouth. His cheeks hollowed rhythmically in and out as he sucked them. Like a dog licking grease off a stick, Junior thought. He turned to Frankie. "Never mind waiting until we get back to town. We're going to stop at the cabin where the old man and the chick were, and whatever they got, these kids are going to get it." Frankie nodded and picked up the boy. Junior picked up the little girl. He could smell her sweat, her fear. He stroked her hair as if he could stroke that oily reek away. "You're all right, honey," he said. "You and your brother both, you're all right. You're safe."
"Do you promise?"
"Yes." Her arms tightened around his neck. It was one of the best things Junior had ever felt in his life. 4. The western side of Chester's Mill was the least populated part of town, and by 9:15 that morning, it was almost entirely clear. The only police car left on Little Bitch was Unit 2.
Jackie Weddington was driving, and Linda Everett was riding shotgun. Chief Perkins, a small-town cop of the old school, would never have sent two women out together, but of course, Chief Perkins was no longer in charge, and the women themselves enjoyed the novelty. Men, especially male cops, with their endless yee-haw banter, could be tiring.
"Ready to go back?" Jackie asked. "Sweetbriar will be closed, but we might be able to beg a cup of coffee."
Linda didn't reply. She was thinking about where the dome cut across Little Bitch. Going out there had been unsettling. And not just because the sentries were still standing with their backs turned, and hadn't budged when she gave them a good morning through the car's roof speaker. It was unsettling because there was now a great big red X spray-painted on the dome, hanging in midair like a sci-fi hologram. That was the projected point of impact. It seemed impossible that a missile fired from 200 or 300 miles away could hit such a small spot, but Rusty had assured her that it could.
"Lynn," she came back to the here and now. "Sure, I'm ready if you are."
The radio crackled.
Unit 2, do you read? Over."
Linda unracked the mic.
"Base, this is 2. We hear you, Stacy, but reception out here isn't very good. Over."
"Everybody says the same," Stacy Moggan replied. "It's worse near the dome. Better as you get closer to town. But you're still on Little Bitch, right? Over."
"Yes," Linda said. "Just check the Killians and the Bouchers. Both gone. If that missile busts through, Roger Killian's going to have a lot of roast chickens. Over."
"We'll have a picnic. Pete wants to talk to you. Chief Randolph, I mean. Over."
Jackie pulled the cruiser to the side of the road. There was a pause with static crackling in it. Then Randolph came on. He didn't bother with any overs. Never had.
"Did you check the church, Unit 2?
"Holy Redeemer?" Linda asked. "Over."
"That's the only one I know out there, Officer Everett, unless a Hindu mosque grew overnight."
Linda didn't think Hindus were the ones who worshipped in mosques, but this didn't seem like the right time for corrections. Randolph sounded tired and grouchy.
"Holy Redeemer wasn't in our sector," she said. "That one belonged to a couple of the new cops, Thibodeau and Searles, I think. Over."
"Check it again," Randolph said, sounding more irritable than ever. "No one's seen Coggins, and a couple of his parishioners want to canoodle with him, or whatever they call it."
Jackie put a finger to her temple and mimed shooting herself. Linda, who wanted to get back and check on her kids at Marta Edmonds' house, nodded.
"Roger that, Chief," Linda said. "We'll do. Over."
"Check the parsonage, too."
There was a pause.
"Also the radio station. The damn thing keeps bellowing away, so there must be someone there."
"Will do."
She started to say over and out, then thought of something else.
"Chief, is there anything new on the TV? Has the president said anything? Over."
"I don't have time to listen to every word that guy drops out of his silly mouth. Just go on and hunt up the Padre and tell him to get his butt back here, and get your butts back, too. Out."
Linda racked the mic and looked at Jackie.
"Get our butts back there?" Jackie said. "Our butts?"
"He's a butt," Linda said. The remark was supposed to be funny, but it fell flat. For a moment, they just sat in the idling car, not talking. Then Jackie spoke in a voice that was almost too low to be heard.
"This is so bad." "Randolph instead of Perkins, you mean?" "That, and the new cops."
She gave the last word verbal quotation marks.
"Those kids. You know what? When I was punching in, Henry Morrison told me Randolph hired 2 more this morning. They came in off the street with Carter Thibodeau, and Pete just signed them up. No questions asked."
Linda knew the sort of guys who hung out with Carter, either at Dipper's or at the gas and grocery, where they used the garage to tune up their finance company motorcycles.
2 more? Why?
"Pete told Henry we might need him if that missile doesn't work. To make sure the situation doesn't get out of hand," he said. "And you know who put that idea in his head?" Linda knew, all right.
"At least they're not carrying guns." "A couple are. Not department issue, they're personals. By tomorrow, if this doesn't end today, that is, they all will be. And as of this morning, Pete's letting them ride together instead of pairing them with real cops.
Some training period, huh? 24 hours, give or take. Do you realize those kids now outnumber us?
Linda considered this silently.
Hitler youth, Jackie said. That's what I keep thinking. Probably overreacting, but I hope to God this thing ends today, and I don't have to find out. I can't quite see Peter Randolph as Hitler.
Me either. I see him more as Hermann Goering. It's Rennie I think of when I think of Hitler.
She put the cruiser in gear, made a K-turn, and headed them back toward Christ, the Holy Redeemer Church.
5. The church was unlocked and empty, the generator off. The parsonage was silent, but Reverend Coggin's Chevrolet was parked in the little garage. Peering in, Linda could read two stickers on the bumper. The one on the right, "If the rapture's today, somebody grab my steering wheel." The one on the left boasted, "My other car is a 10-speed. Linda called the second one to Jackie's attention.
"He does have a bike. I've seen him riding it, but I don't see it in the garage, so maybe he rode it into town. Saving gas?"
"Maybe," Jackie said, "and maybe we ought to check the house to make sure he didn't slip in the shower and break his neck."
"Does that mean we might have to look at him naked?"
"No one said police work was pretty," Jackie said. "Come on." The house was locked, but in towns where seasonal residents form a large part of the population, the police are adept at gaining entry. They check the usual places for a spare key. Jackie was the one who found it, hanging on a hook behind a kitchen shutter. It opened the back door.
"Reverend Coggins?" Linda called, sticking her head in. "It's the police, Reverend Coggins. Are you here?"
No answer. They went in. The lower floor was neat and orderly, but it gave Linda an uncomfortable feeling. She told herself it was just being in someone else's house, a religious person's house, and uninvited. Jackie went upstairs.
"Reverend Coggins, police. If you're here, please make yourself known."
Linda stood at the foot of the stairs, looking up. The house felt wrong, somehow. That made her think of Janelle, shaking in the grip of her seizure. That had been wrong, too. A queer certainty stole into her mind. If Janelle were here right now, she would have another seizure. Yes, and start talking about queer things. Halloween. And the Great Pumpkin, maybe. It was a perfectly ordinary flight of stairs. But she didn't want to go up there. Just wanted Jackie to report the place was empty so they could go on to the radio station. But when her partner called for her to come up, Linda did. 6. Jackie was standing in the middle of Coggin's bedroom. There was a plain wooden cross on one wall and a plaque on another. The plaque read, "His eye is on the sparrow." The coverlet of the bed was turned back. There were traces of blood on the sheet beneath. "And this," Jackie said, "come around here." Reluctantly, Linda did. Lying on the polished wood floor between the bed and the wall was a knotted length of rope. The knots were bloody.
"Looks like somebody beat him," Jackie said grimly. "Hard enough to knock him out, maybe, then they laid him on the..."
She looked at the other woman.
"No? I take it you didn't grow up in a religious home," Linda said.
"I did so. We worshiped the Holy Trinity, Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy. What about you?"
"Plain old Tapwater Baptist, but I heard about things like this. I think he was flagellating himself."
"Yug!
People do that for sins, right?"
"Yes, and I don't think it ever went entirely out of style." "Then this makes sense. Sort of. Go in the bathroom and look on the toilet tank." Linda made no move to do so. The knotted rope was bad enough. The feel of the house, too empty somehow, was worse.
"Go on. It's nothing that'll bite you, and I'll bet you a dollar to a dime that you've seen worse."
Linda went into the bathroom. Two magazines were lying on top of the toilet tank. One was a devotional, The Upper Room. The other was called Young Oriental Slits. Linda doubted if that one was sold in many religious bookshops.
"So," Jackie said, "are we getting a picture here? He sits on the john, tosses the truffle."
"Tosses the truffle?" Linda giggled in spite of her nerves.
or because of them.
It's what my mother used to call it, Jackie said. Anyway, after he's done with that, he opens a medium-sized can of whoop-ass to expiate his sins, then goes to bed and has happy Asian dreams. This morning he gets up, refreshed and sin-free, does his morning devotionals, then rides into town on his bike. Makes sense?
It did.
It just didn't explain why the house felt so wrong to her.
Let's check the radio station, she said. Then we'll head into town ourselves and get coffee. I'm buying.
Good, Jackie said. I want mine black, preferably in a hypo.
7. The low-slung, mostly glass WCIK studio was also locked. But speakers mounted beneath the eaves were playing Good Night, Sweet Jesus, as interpreted by that noted soul singer Perry Como. Behind the studio, the broadcast tower loomed, the flashing red lights at the top barely visible in the strong morning light. Near the tower was a long barn-like structure, which Linda assumed must hold the station's generator and whatever other supplies it needed to keep beaming the miracle of God's love to western Maine, eastern New Hampshire, and possibly the inner planets of the solar system. Jackie knocked, then hammered.
I don't think anybody's here, Linda said.
But this place seemed wrong, too. And the air had a funny smell, stale and sallow. It reminded her of the way her mother's kitchen smelled, even after a good airing, because her mother smoked like a chimney and believed the only things worth eating were those fried in a hot skillet greased with plenty of lard.
Jackie shook her head. We heard someone, didn't we?
Linda had no answer for that because it was true. They had been listening to the station on their drive from the parsonage and had heard a smooth DJ announcing the next record as Another Message of God's Love and Song. This time the hunt for the key was longer, but Jackie finally found it in an envelope taped beneath the mailbox. With it was a scrap of paper on which someone had scrawled 1693. The key was a dupe and a little sticky, but after some chivying, it worked. As soon as they were in, they heard the steady beep of the security system. The keypad was on the wall. When Jackie punched in the numbers, the beeping quit. Now there was only the music. Perry Como had given way to something instrumental. Linda thought it sounded suspiciously like the organ solo from Inagata da Vida. The speakers in here were 1,000 times better than the ones outside, and the music was louder, almost like a living thing. Did people work in this holier-than-thou racket? Linda wondered. Answer the phones? Do business? How could they? There was something wrong in here, too. Linda was sure of it. The place felt more than creepy to her. It felt outright dangerous. When she saw that Jackie had unsnapped the strap on her service automatic, Linda did the same. The feel of the gun butt under her hand was good. Thy rod and thy gun butt, they comfort me, she thought. Hello, Jackie called.
Reverend Coggins?
Anybody? There was no answer. The reception desk was empty. To the left of it were 2 closed doors. Straight ahead was a window running the entire length of the main room. Linda could see blinking lights inside it. The broadcast studio, she assumed. Jackie pushed the closed doors open with her foot, standing well back. Behind one was an office. Behind the other was a conference room of surprising luxury, dominated by a giant flat-screen TV. It was on, but muted. Anderson Cooper, almost life-sized, looked like he was doing his stand-up on Castle Rock's Main Street. The buildings were draped with flags and yellow ribbons. Linda saw a sign on the hardware store that read, Set Them Free. That made Linda feel even eerier. The super running across the bottom of the screen read, Defense Department sources claim missile strike is imminent.
Why is the TV on? Jackie asked.
Because whoever was minding the store left it that way when a booming voice interrupted her.
That was Raymond Howell's version of Christ, my Lord and Leader.
Both women jumped.
And this is Norman Drake, reminding you of 3 important facts. You're listening to the Revival Time Hour on WCIK. God loves you. And he sent his son to die for you on Calvary's cross. It's 9:25 a.m., and as always, we like to remind you, time is short. Have you given your heart to the Lord? Back after this.
Norman Drake gave way to a silver-tongued devil selling the entire Bible on DVDs, and the best thing about it was you could pay in monthly installments and return the whole deal if you weren't just as happy as a pig in shit. Linda and Jackie went to the broadcast studio window and looked in. Neither Norman Drake nor the silver-tongued devil was there. But when the commercial ended and the DJ came back to announce the next song of praise, a green light turned red, and a red light turned green. When the music started up, another red light went green.
It's automated, Jackie said, the whole freaking thing. Then why do we feel like someone's here? And don't say you don't.
Jackie didn't.
Because it's weird. The jock even does time checks. Honey, this setup must have cost a fortune. Talk about the ghost in the machine. How long do you think it will run?
Probably till the propane runs out and the generator stops.
Linda spotted another closed door and opened it with her foot, as Jackie had. Only unlike Jackie, she drew her gun and held it, safety on and muzzle down, beside her leg. It was a bathroom, and it was empty. There was, however, a picture of a very Caucasian Jesus on the wall.
I'm not religious, Jackie said, so you'll have to explain to me why people would want Jesus watching them poop.
Linda shook her head.
Let's get out of here before I lose it, she said. This place is the Radioland version of the Mary Celeste.
Jackie looked around uneasily.
Well, the vibe is spooky, I'll give you that.
She suddenly raised her voice in a harsh shout that made Linda jump. She wanted to tell Jackie not to yell like that, because someone might hear her and come. Or something.
Hey! Yo! Anybody here? Last chance!
Nothing. No one. Outside, Linda took a deep breath.
Once when I was a teenager, some friends and I went to Bar Harbor, and we stopped for a picnic at this scenic turnout. There were half a dozen of us. The day was clear, and you could see practically all the way to Ireland. When we were done eating, I said I wanted to take a picture. My friends were all horsing around and grab-assing, and I kept backing up, trying to get everyone in the frame. Then this one girl, Arabella, my best friend back then, stopped trying to give this other girl a wedgie and shouted, "Stop, Linda, stop." I stopped and looked around. Know what I saw?
Jackie shook her head.
The Atlantic Ocean. I'd backed up all the way to the drop-off at the edge of the picnic area. There was a warning sign, but no fence or guardrail. One more step and I would have gone down. And how I felt then is how I felt in there. Lynn, it was empty. I don't think so, and I don't think you do either.
It was spooky, sure, but we checked the rooms.
Not the studio. Plus the TV was on and the music was too loud. You don't think they'd turn it up that loud ordinarily, do you?
How do I know what holy rollers do? Jackie asked.
Maybe they were expecting the apocalypse.
Lips. Whatever. Do you want to check the storage barn?
Absolutely not, Linda said, and that made Jackie snort laughter.
Okay, our report is no sign of the Rev, correct?
Correct.
Then we're off to town, and coffee.
Before getting into Unit 2's shotgun seat, Linda took one more look at the studio building, sitting there wreathed in white bread audio joy. There was no other sound. She realized she didn't hear a single bird singing, and wondered if they had all killed themselves smashing into the dome. Surely that wasn't possible. Was it? Jackie pointed at the mic.
Want me to give the place a shout through the loudspeaker? Say if anyone's hiding in there, they should beat feet into town? Because I just thought of this. Maybe they were scared of us. What I want is for you to stop screwing around and get out of here.
Jackie didn't argue. She reversed down the short driveway to Little Bitch Road and turned the cruiser toward the mill. 8. Time passed. Religious music played. Norman Drake returned and announced that it was 9:34, Eastern Daylight God Loves You time. This was followed by an ad for Jim Rennie's used cars, delivered by the second selectman himself.
It's our annual fall sale spectacular, and boy, did we overstock, Big Jim said in a rueful, the joke's on me voice. We've got Fords, Chevys, Plymouths. We've got the hard-to-get Dodge Ram and even the harder-to-get Mustang. Folks, I'm sitting on not one or two, but three Mustangs that are like new. One, the famous V6 convertible, and each comes with the famous Jim Rennie Christian guarantee. We service what we sell, we finance, and we do it all at low, low prices. And right now, he chuckled more ruefully than ever, we've just got to clear this lot. So come on down. The coffee pot's always on, neighbor, and you'll love the feeling when Big Jim's dealing.
A door neither woman had noticed eased open at the back of the studio. Inside were more blinking lights, a galaxy of them. The room was little more than a cubby choked with wires, splitters, routers, and electronic boxes. You would have said there was no room for a man. But the chef was beyond skinny. He was emaciated. His eyes were only glitters sunk deep in his skull. His skin was pale and blotchy. His lips folded loosely inward over gums that had lost most of their teeth. His shirt and pants were filthy, and his hips were naked wings. Chef's underwear days were now just a memory. It is doubtful that Sammy Bushy would have recognized her missing husband. He had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in one hand. He could only eat soft things now. And a Glock 9 in the other. He went to the window overlooking the parking lot, thinking he'd rush out and kill the intruders if they were still there. He had almost done it while they were inside. Only he'd been afraid. Because demons couldn't actually be killed. When their human bodies died, they just flew into another host. When they were between bodies, the demons looked like blackbirds. Chef had seen this in vivid dreams that came on the increasingly rare occasions when he slept. They were gone, however. His Atman had been too strong for them. Rennie had told him he had to shut down out back, and Chef Bushy had. But he might have to start up some of the cookers again because there had been a big shipment to Boston a week ago, and he was almost out of product. He needed smoke. It was what his Atman fed on these days. But for now he had enough. He had given up on the blues music that had been so important to him in his Phil Bushy stage of life. B.B. King, Coco and Hound Dog Taylor, Muddy and Howlin' Wolf, even the immortal little Walter. He had given up on fucking. He had even pretty much given up on moving his bowels, had been constipated since July, but that was okay. What humiliated the body fed the Atman. He checked the parking lot and the road beyond once more to make sure the demons weren't lurking. Then tucked the automatic into his belt at the small of his back and headed for the storage shed, which was actually more of a factory these days. A factory that was shut down. But he could and would fix that if necessary. Chef went to get his pipe. 9. Rusty Everett stood looking into the storage shed behind the hospital. He was using a flashlight because he and Ginny Tomlinson, now the administrative head of medical services in Chester's Mill, crazy as that was, had decided to kill the power to every part of the plant that didn't absolutely need it. From his left, in its own shed, he could hear the big generator roaring away, eating ever deeper into the current long tank of propane. "Most of the tanks are gone," Twitch had said. And by God, they were. According to the card on the door, there's supposed to be 7, but there's only 2. On that, Twitch was wrong. There was only 1. Rusty ran the beam of his flashlight over the blue CRHOSP, stenciled on the tank's silver side below the supply company's Dead River logo.
"Told you," Twitch said from behind him, making Rusty jump.
"You told me wrong, there's only 1.
"Bullshit!"
Twitch stepped into the doorway. Looked while Rusty shone the beam around, highlighting boxes of supplies surrounding a large and largely empty center area. Said,
"It's not bullshit."
"No."
"Fearless leader, someone is stealing our propane."
Rusty didn't want to believe this, but saw no way around it. Twitch squatted down.
"Look here."
Rusty dropped to one knee. The quarter acre behind the hospital had been asphalted the previous summer, and without any cold weather to crack or buckle it, not yet anyway, the area was a smooth black sheet. It made it easy to see the tire tracks in front of the shed sliding doors.
That looks like it could have been a town truck,
Twitch remarked. Or any other big truck.
Nevertheless, you might want to check the storage shed behind the town hall. Twitch no trust him Big Chief Rennie. Him bad medicine.
Why would he take our propane? The selectmen have plenty of their own.
They walked to the door leading into the hospital's laundry, also shut down, at least for the time being. There was a bench beside the door. A sign posted on the bricks read, "Smoking here will be banned as of January 1st. Quit now and avoid the rush." Twitch took out his Marlboros and offered them to Rusty. Rusty waved them away, then reconsidered and took one. Twitch lit them up.
"How do you know?"
he asked.
"How do I know what?"
"That they've got plenty of their own. Have you checked?"
"No," Rusty said, "but if they were going to poach, why from us? Not only is stealing from the local hospital usually considered bad form by the better class of people, the post office is practically right next door. They must have some."
"Maybe Rennie and his friends already snatched the post office's gas. How much would they have, anyway? One tank, two? Peanuts."
"I don't understand why they'd need any. It makes no sense."
"Nothing about any of this makes sense,"
Twitch said, and yawned so hugely that Rusty could hear his jaws creak. "You finished rounds, I take it?"
Rusty had a moment to consider the surreal quality of that question. Since Haskell's death, Rusty had become the hospital's head doc, and Twitch, a nurse just 3 days ago, was now what Rusty had been, a physician's assistant.
"Yep," Twitch sighed. "Mr. Carty isn't going to live out the day."
Rusty had thought the same thing about Ed Carty, who was suffering from end-stage stomach cancer a week ago, and the man was still hanging in.
"Comatose?" "Roger that, Sensei."
Twitch was able to count their other patients off on the digits of one hand, which Rusty knew was extraordinarily lucky. He thought he might even have felt lucky, if he hadn't been so tired and worried.
"George Werner, I'd call stable."
Werner, an Eastchester resident, 60 years old and obese, had suffered a myocardial infarction on Dome Day. Rusty thought he would pull through. This time.
"As for Emily Whitehouse," Twitch shrugged, "it ain't good, Sensei."
Emmy Whitehouse, 40 years old and not even an ounce overweight, had suffered her own MI an hour or so after Rory Dinsmore's accident. It had been much worse than George Werner's, because she'd been an exercise freak, and had suffered what Doc Haskell had called a health club blowout.
"The Freeman girl is getting better, Jimmy Saroy is holding up, and Nora Coveland is totally cool. Out after lunch. On the whole, not so bad."
"No," Rusty said, "but it'll get worse, I guarantee you. And if you suffered a catastrophic head injury, would you want me to operate on you?"
"Not really," Twitch said. "I keep hoping Gregory House will show up."
Rusty butted his cigarette in the can and looked at the nearly empty supply shed. Maybe he should have a peek into the storage facility behind the town hall. What could it hurt? This time he was the one who yawned.
"How long can you keep this up?" Twitch asked.
All the banter had gone out of his voice.
"I only ask because right now, you're what this town's got."
"As long as I have to. What worries me is getting so tired I screw something up, and of facing stuff that's way beyond my skill set."
He thought of Rory Dinsmore and Jimmy Saroy. Thinking of Jimmy was worse because Rory was now beyond the possibility of medical mistakes. Jimmy, on the other hand. Rusty saw himself back in the operating room, listening to the soft bleep of the equipment, saw himself looking down at Jimmy's pale, bare leg, with a black line drawn on it where the cut would have to be made. Thought of Dougie Twitchell trying out his anesthesiologist skills. Felt Ginny Tomlinson slapping a scalpel into his gloved hand, and then looking at him over the top of her mask with her cool blue eyes. "God, spare me from that," he thought. Twitch put a hand on Rusty's arm.
"Take it easy," he said. "One day at a time."
"Fuck that. 1 hour at a time," Rusty said, and got up. "I have to go over to the health center, see what's shaking there. Thank Christ this didn't happen in the summer. We would have had 3,000 tourists and 700 summer camp kids on our hands."
"Want me to come?"
Rusty shook his head. "Check on Ed Carty again, why don't you? See if he's still in the land of the living."
Rusty took one more look at the supply shed,
then plotted around the corner of the building and on a diagonal toward the health center on the far side of Catherine Russell Drive. 10. Ginny was at the hospital, of course. She would give Mrs. Covland's new bundle of joy a final weigh-in before sending them home. The receptionist on duty at the health center was 17-year-old Gina Buffalino, who had exactly 6 weeks' worth of medical experience. As a candy striper, she gave Rusty a deer-in-the-headlights look when he came in that made his heart sink. But the waiting room was empty, and that was a good thing. A very good thing. Any call-ins? Rusty asked.
One. Mrs. Venziano, out on the Black Ridge Road. Her baby got his head caught between the bars of his playpen. She wanted an ambulance. I told her to grease the kid's head up with olive oil and see if she could get him out that way. It worked.
Rusty grinned. Maybe there was hope for this kid yet. Gina, looking divinely relieved, grinned back.
Place is empty, at least, Rusty said, which is great.
Not quite. Ms. Grinnell is here. Andrea, I put her in 3.
Gina hesitated.
She seemed pretty upset.
Rusty's heart, which had begun to rise, sank back down again. Andrea Grinnell. And upset, which meant she wanted a bump on her OxyContin prescription, which he in all good conscience could not give, even supposing Andy Sanders had enough stock to fill it.
Okay.
He started down the hall to exam room 3, then stopped and looked back.
You didn't page me.
Gina flushed.
She asked me specifically not to?
This puzzled Rusty, but only for a second. Andrea might have a pill problem, but she was no dummy. She'd known that if Rusty was over at the hospital, he was probably with Twitch. And Dougie Twitchell happened to be her baby brother, who even at the age of 39 must be protected from the evil facts of life. Rusty stood at the door with the black 3 decaled on it, trying to gather himself. This was going to be hard. Andrea wasn't one of the defiant boozers he saw who claimed that alcohol formed absolutely no part of their problems. Nor was she one of the meth heads who had been showing up with increasing frequency over the last year or so. Andrea's responsibility for her problem was more difficult to pinpoint, and that complicated the treatment. Certainly she'd been in agony after her fall. Oxy had been the best thing for her, allowing her to cope with the pain so she could sleep and begin therapy. It wasn't her fault that the drug which allowed her to do those things was the one doctors sometimes called hillbilly heroin. He opened the door and went in, rehearsing his refusal. Kind but firm, he told himself. Kind but firm. She was sitting in the corner chair under the cholesterol poster, knees together, head bowed over the purse in her lap. She was a big woman, who now looked small, diminished somehow. When she raised her head to look at him and he saw how haggard her face was, the lines bracketing her mouth deep, the skin under her eyes almost black, he changed his mind and decided to write the script on one of Dr. Haskell's pink pads after all. Maybe after the dome crisis was over, he'd try to get her into a detox program, threatened to tattle to her brother if that was what it took. Now, however, he would give her what she needed, because he had rarely seen need so stark.
Eric. Rusty. I'm in trouble.
I know, I can see it. I'll write you a...
No.
She was looking at him with something like horror.
Not even if I beg. I am a drug addict, and I have to get off. I'm just a darn old junkie.
Her face folded in on itself. She tried to will it straight again and couldn't. She put her hands over it instead. Big, wrenching sobs that were hard to listen to came through her fingers. Rusty went to her, going down on one knee and putting an arm around her. Andrea, it's good that you want to stop. Excellent, but this might not be the best time. She looked at him with streaming, reddened eyes.
You're right about that. It's the worst time, but it has to be now. And you mustn't tell Dougie or Rose. Can you help me? Can it even be done? Because I haven't been able to. Not on my own. Those hateful pink pills. I put them in the medicine cabinet and say no more today, and an hour later I'm taking them down again. I've never been in a mess like this, not in my whole life.
She dropped her voice as if confiding a great secret.
I don't think it's my back anymore. I think it's my brain telling my back to hurt, so I can go on taking those damn pills.
Why now, Andrea?
She only shook her head.
Can you help me or not?
Yes, but if you're thinking about going cold turkey, don't. For one thing, you're apt to.
For a brief moment, he saw Janny, shaking in her bed, muttering about the great pumpkin.
You're apt to have seizures.
She either didn't register that or set it aside.
How long?
To get past the physical part? 2 weeks. Maybe three. And that's putting you on the fast track, he thought, but didn't say.
She gripped his arm. Her hand was very cold.
Too slow.
An exceedingly unpleasant idea surfaced in Rusty's mind. Probably just transient paranoia brought on by stress, but persuasive.
Andrea, is someone blackmailing you?
Are you kidding? Everyone knows I take those pills. It's a small town.
Which did not, in Rusty's opinion, actually answer the question.
What's the absolute shortest it can take?
With B12 shots plus thiamine and vitamins, you might manage it in 10 days, but you'd be miserable. You wouldn't be able to sleep much, and you'll have restless leg syndrome. Not mild either, they don't call it kicking the habit for nothing. And you'd have to have someone administer the step-down dosage, someone who can hold the pills and won't give them to you when you ask, because you will.
10 days.
She looked hopeful.
And this might be over by then anyway, yes? This dome thing?
Maybe this afternoon, that's what we all hope.
10 days,
she said.
10 days. And, he thought, you'll want those goddamn things for the rest of your life.
But this he didn't say aloud either.
11.
Sweetbriar Rose had been extraordinarily busy for a Monday morning. But, of course, there had never been a Monday morning like this in the town's history. Still, the patrons had left willingly enough when Rose announced the grill was closed and wouldn't reopen until 5 that afternoon.
"And by then maybe you can all go over to Moxie's in Castle Rock and eat there," she finished. That had brought spontaneous applause, even though Moxie's was a famously filthy grease pit.
"No lunch?" Ernie Calvert asked.
Rose looked at Barbie, who raised his hands to his shoulders. "Don't ask me."
"Sandwiches," Rose said, "until they're gone."
This had brought more applause. People seemed surprisingly upbeat this morning. There had been laughter and raillery. Perhaps the best sign of the town's improved mental health was at the rear of the restaurant, where the bullshit table was back in session. The TV over the counter, now locked on CNN, was a big part of the reason. The talking heads had little more to broadcast than rumors, but most were hopeful. Several scientists who'd been interviewed said the cruise had a good chance of smashing through and ending the crisis. One estimated the chances of success as better than 80%. But, of course, he's at MIT in Cambridge, Barbie thought. He can afford optimism. Now, as he scraped the grill, a knock came at the door. Barbie looked around and saw Julia Shumway with 3 children clustered around her. They made her look like a junior high school teacher on a field trip. Barbie went to the door, wiping his hands on his apron.
"If we let everyone in who wants to eat, we'll be out of food in no time," Anson said irritably from where he was swabbing down tables.
Rose had gone back to Food City to try and purchase more meat. "I don't think she wants to eat," Barbie said, and he was right about that.
"Good morning, Colonel Barbara,"
Julia said with her little Mona Lisa smile. "I keep wanting to call you Major Barbara, like the play, I know." Barbie had heard this one a few times before, like 10,000. "Is this your posse?" One of the children was an extremely tall, extremely skinny boy with a mop of dark brown hair. One was a stocky young fellow wearing baggy shorts and a faded 50-cent t-shirt. The third was a pretty little girl with a lightning bolt on her cheek. A decal rather than a tattoo, but it still gave her a certain savoir-faire. He realized if he told her she looked like the middle school version of Joan Jett, she wouldn't know who he was talking about.
"Nori Calvert?" Julia said, touching the riot girl's shoulder. "Benny Drake, and this tall drink of water is Joseph McClatchy. Yesterday's protest demonstration was his idea."
"But I never meant anyone to get hurt," Joe said.
"And it wasn't your fault they did," Barbie told him, "so rest easy on that."
"Are you really the bull goose?" Benny asked, looking him over.
Barbie laughed. "No," he said, "and I'm not even going to try and be the bull goose unless I absolutely have to."
"But you know the soldiers out there, right?"
Nori asked.
Well, not personally. For one thing, they're Marines. I was Army.
You're still Army, according to Colonel Cox, Julia said. She was wearing her cool little smile, but her eyes were dancing with excitement.
Can we talk to you? Young Mr. McClatchy has had an idea, and I think it's brilliant, if it works.
It'll work, Joe said. When it comes to computer shit stuff, I'm the bull goose.
Step into my office, Barbie said, and escorted them toward the counter. 12.
It was brilliant, all right. But it was already going on 10:30, and if they were really going to make this thing happen, they would have to move fast.
He turned to Julia. Do you have your cell... Julia slapped it smartly into his palm before he could finish.
Cox's number is in memory.
Great, now if I knew how to access the memory. Joe took the phone.
What are you, from the Dark Ages?
Yes, Barbie said. When knights were bold and ladies fair, went without their underwear. Nori laughed hard at that, and when she raised her fist, Barbie tapped her small fist with his big one. Joe pushed a couple of buttons on the minuscule keypad. He listened, then handed the cell to Barbie. Cox must still have been sitting with one hand on the phone because he was already on when Barbie put Julia's cell to his ear.
How's it going, Colonel?
Cox asked.
We're basically okay.
And that's a start. Easy for you to say, Barbie thought. I imagine things will remain basically okay until the missile either bounces off or punches through and does gross damage to the woods and farms on our side, which the citizens of Chester's Mill would welcome.
What are your guys saying?
Not much. No one is making any predictions.
That's not what we're hearing on the TV.
I don't have time to keep up with the talking heads.
Barbie could hear the shrug in Cox's voice.
We're hopeful. We think we've got a shot, to coin a phrase.
Julia was opening and closing her hands in a what gives gesture. Colonel Cox, I'm sitting here with four friends. One of them is a young man named Joe McClatchy, who's had a pretty cool idea. I'm going to put him on the phone with you right now. Joe was shaking his head hard enough to make his hair fly. Barbie paid no attention. To explain it. And he handed Joe the cell.
Talk, he said.
But...
Don't argue with the bull goose, son. Talk.
Joe did so diffidently at first, with a lot of ahs and erms and you-knows. But as his idea took hold of him again, he sped up, became articulate. Then he listened. After a little while, he started to grin. A few moments later, he said, "Yes, sir. Thank you, sir," and handed the phone back to Barbie.
"Check it out.
They're going to try to augment our Wi-Fi before they shoot the missile. Jesus, this is hot."
Julia grabbed his arms and Joe said, "I'm sorry, Ms. Shumway, I mean jeepers."
"Never mind that. Can you really work this thing?"
"You kidding? No prob."
"Colonel Cox," Barbie asked, "is this true about the Wi-Fi?"
"We can't stop anything you folks want to try to do," Cox said. "I think you were the one who originally pointed that out to me, so we might as well help. You'll have the fastest internet in the world, at least for today." "That's some bright kid you got there, by the way."
"Yes, sir, that was my impression," Barbie said, and gave Joe a thumbs up. The kid was glowing.
Cox said, "If the boy's idea works and you record it, make sure we get a copy. We'll be making our own, of course, but the scientists in charge of this thing will want to see what the hit looks like from your side of the dome."
"I think we can do better than that," Barbie said. "If Joe here can put this together, I think most of the town will be able to watch it live." This time, Julia raised her fist. Grinning, Barbie bumped it.
13.
"Holy shit," Joe said.
The awe on his face made him look 8 instead of 13. The whipcrack confidence was gone from his voice. He and Barbie were standing about 30 yards from where Little Bitch Road ran up against the dome. It wasn't the soldiers he was looking at, although they had turned around to observe. It was the warning band and the big red X sprayed on the dome that had fascinated him. "They're moving their bivouac point, or whatever you call it," Julia said. "The tents are gone."
"Sure, in about..." Barbie looked at his watch. 90 minutes, it's going to get very hot over there.
"Son, you better get to it." But now that they were actually out here on the deserted road, Barbie began to wonder if Joe could do what he had promised.
"Yeah, but...
Do you see the trees?
Barbie didn't understand at first. He looked at Julia, who shrugged. Then Joe pointed, and he saw. The trees on the Tarker's side of the dome were dancing in a moderate fall wind, shedding leaves in colorful bursts that fluttered down around the watching marine sentries. On the male side, the branches were barely moving, and most of the trees were still fully dressed. Barbie was pretty sure air was coming through the barrier, but not with any force. The dome was damping the wind. He thought of how he and Paul Gendron, the guy in the sea dog's cap, had come to the little stream and had seen the water piling up. Julia said, "The leaves over here, look."
"I don't know."
"Listless, somehow limp."
"It's just because they've got a wind on their side and we've only got a puff of breeze," Barbie said. Then wondered if that was really it. Or all of it. But what good did it do to speculate about the current air quality in Chester's Mill when there was nothing they could do about it? "Go on, Joe. Do your thing." They had swung by the McClatchy house in Julia's Prius to get Joe's power book. Mrs. McClatchy had made Barbie swear he would keep her son safe, and Barbie had so sworn. Now, Joe pointed at the road. "Here?" Barbie raised his hands to the side of his face and sighted at the red X. "Little to the left. Can you try it? See how it looks?"
"Yeah."
Joe opened the power book and turned it on. The Mac power-up chime sounded as pretty as ever, but Barbie thought he had never seen anything quite so surreal as the silver computer sitting on the patched asphalt of Little Bitch Road with its screen up. It seemed to summarize the last 3 days perfectly.
"Battery's fresh, so it should run for at least 6 hours," Joe said. "Won't it go to sleep?" Julia asked.
Joe gave her an indulgent, "Mother, please," look. Then he turned back to Barbie.
"If the missile roasts my pro, do you promise to buy me another one?"
"Uncle Sam will buy you another one," Barbie promised. "I'll put in the requisition myself."
"Sweet."
Joe bent over the power book. There was a little silver barrel mounted atop the screen. This, Joe had told them, was some current compu miracle called EyeSight. He ran his finger over the computer's touchpad, hit enter, and suddenly the screen filled with a brilliant image of Little Bitch Road. From ground level, each little bump and irregularity in the tar looked like a mountain. At mid-range, Barbie could see the marine sentries up to their knees.
"Sir, does he have a picture, sir?"
one of them asked. Barbie looked up.
"Let's put it this way, Marine. If I was doing inspection, you'd be doing push-ups with my foot in your ass. There's a scuff on your left boot. Unacceptable in a non-combat assignment."
The Marine looked down at his boot, which was indeed scuffed. Julia laughed. Joe did not. He was absorbed.
"It's too low. Ms. Shumway, have you got something in the car we can use to..."
He raised his hand about 3 feet off the road.
"I do," she said. "And get me my little gym bag, please."
He fiddled some more with the power book, then held out his hand.
"Sell?"
Barbie handed it to him. Joe hit the tiny buttons with blinding speed. Then,
"Benny? Nori, okay. You guys there? Good. Never been in a beer joint before, I bet. You ready? Excellent. Stand by."
He listened, then grinned.
"Are you kidding? Dude, according to what I'm getting, the jack is awesome. They're blasting the Wi-Fi. Got a jet."
He snapped the phone closed and handed it back to Barbie. Julia came back with Joe's gym bag and a carton containing undistributed sheets of the Democrat Sunday Extra Edition. Joe set the power book on the carton. The sudden rise in the image from ground level made Barbie a bit dizzy. Then checked it and pronounced it totally rad. He rummaged in the gym bag, brought out a black box with an antenna, and plugged it into the computer. The soldiers were clustered on their side of the dome, watching with interest. "Now I know how a fish feels in an aquarium," Barbie thought.
"Looks okay," Joe murmured. "I got a green bulb."
"Shouldn't you call your..." "If it's working, they'll call me," Joe said. Then,
"Uh-oh. This could be trouble."
Barbie thought he was referring to the computer, but the boy wasn't even looking at it. Barbie followed his gaze and saw the green chief of police car. It wasn't moving fast, but the bubblegums were pulsing. Pete Randolph got out from behind the wheel, emerging from the passenger side.
The cruiser rocked a little when his weight left the springs. Came Big Jim Rennie.
"Just what in the heck do you think you're doing?" he asked.
The phone in Barbie's hand buzzed. He handed it to Joe without taking his eyes from the approaching selectman and chief of police. 14. The sign over the door of Dippers said, "Welcome to the biggest dance floor in Maine." And for the first time in the Roadhouse's history, that floor was crowded at 11:45 in the morning. Tommy and Willow Anderson greeted people at the door as they arrived, a little like ministers welcoming parishioners to church. In this case, the first church of rock bands direct from Boston. At first, the audience was quiet, because there was nothing on the big screen but one blue word. Waiting. Benny and Nori had plugged in their equipment and switched the TV's feed to input 4. Then, suddenly, Little Bitch Road appeared in living color, complete with brightly colored leaves swirling down around the marine sentries. The crowd broke into applause and cheers. Benny gave Nori a high five, but that wasn't enough for Nori. She kissed him on the mouth, and hard. It was the happiest moment of Benny's life, even better than staying vertical while doing a full pipe roughie.
"Call him," Nori demanded.
"Right on," Benny said.
His face felt as if it might actually catch fire and burn, but he was grinning. He punched redial and held the phone to his ear.
"Dude, we got it. The picture's so radical, it..."
Joe cut him off.
"Houston, we have a problem."
15.
"I don't know what you folks think you're doing," Chief Randall said, "but I want an explanation, and that thing's shut down until I get one."
He pointed at the power book.
"Pardon me, sir," one of the Marines said.
He was wearing a second lieutenant's stripes.
"That's Colonel Barbara, and he has official government sanction for this operation."
To this, Big Jim offered his most sarcastic smile. A vein in his neck was throbbing.
"This man is a colonel of nothing but troublemakers. He cooks in the local restaurant."
"Sir, my orders..."
Big Jim shook his finger at the second lieutenant.
"In Chester's Mill, the only official government we're recognizing right now is our own soldier, and I am its representative."
He turned to Randolph.
"Chief, if that kid won't turn it off, pull the plug."
"It has no plug that I can see," Randolph said.
He was looking from Barbie to the Marine second lieutenant to Big Jim. He had begun to sweat.
"Then put a boot through the darn screen. Just kill it."
Randolph stepped forward. Joe, looking scared but determined, stepped in front of the power book on the carton. He still had the cell phone in his hand.
"You better not. It's mine, and I'm not breaking any laws."
"Get back, Chief," Barbie said. "That's an order. If you still recognize the government of the country you live in, you'll obey it." Randolph looked around.
"Jim, maybe..."
"Maybe nothing," Big Jim said. "Right now, this is the country you live in. Kill that cotton-picking computer."
Julia stepped forward, grabbed the power book, and turned it so that the eye vision camera was taking in the new arrivals. Tendrils of hair had escaped her businesslike bun and hung against her pink cheeks. Barbie thought she looked extraordinarily beautiful.
"Ask Nori if they see," she told Joe.
Big Jim's smile froze into a grimace.
"Woman, put that down.
Ask them if they see."
Joe spoke into the phone, listened, then said,
"They do. They're seeing Mr. Rennie and Officer Randolph. Nori says they want to know what's happening."
There was dismay on Randolph's face, fury on Rennie's.
"Who wants to know?" Randolph asked.
Julia said,
"We've set up a live feed to Dippers."
"That sin pit," Big Jim said.
His hands were clenched. Barbie estimated the man was probably 100 pounds overweight, and he grimaced when he moved his right arm, as if he'd strained it, but he looked like he could still hit, and right now he looked mad enough to take a swing, although whether at him, Julia, or the boy, he didn't know. Maybe Rennie didn't either.
"People have been gathering there since 11:15, she said. "News travels fast."
She smiled, with her head cocked to one side. "Would you like to wave to your constituency, Big Jim?"
"It's a bluff," Big Jim said.
"Why would I bluff about something so easy to check?"
She turned to Randolph.
Call one of your cops and ask them where the big gathering in town is this morning.
Then back to Jim again.
If you shut this down, hundreds of people will know you closed off their view of an event that vitally concerns them. One their lives may depend on, in fact.
You had no sanction.
Barbie, ordinarily quite good at controlling himself, felt his temper fraying. It wasn't that the man was stupid. He clearly wasn't. And that was exactly what was making Barbie mad. What is your problem exactly? Do you see any danger here? Because I don't. The idea is to set this thing up, leave it broadcasting, then clear out.
If the missile doesn't work, it could cause a panic. Knowing something failed is one thing. Actually seeing it fail is another. They're apt to do any darn old thing.
You have a very low opinion of the people you govern, Selectman. Big Jim opened his mouth to retort. Something like, and they have justified it time and again, would have been Barbie's guess. But then remembered that a good portion of the town was watching this confrontation on the big screen TV. Possibly in HD.
I'd like you to wipe that sarcastic smile off your face, Barbara.
Are we now policing expressions, too? Julia asked.
Scarecrow Joe covered his mouth, but not before Randolph and Big Jim saw the kid's grin and heard the snicker that escaped from between his fingers. People, the second lieutenant said, you had better clear the scene. Time is passing. Julia, turn that camera on me, Barbie said. She did so. 16. Dippers had never been so packed. Not even at the memorable New Year's Eve show in 2009 featuring the Vatican sex kittens. And it had never been so silent. Over 500 people stood shoulder to shoulder and hip to hip, watching as the camera on Joe's PowerBook Pro did a dizzying 180 and came to rest on Dale Barbara.
There's my boy,
Rose Twitchell murmured and smiled. Hello there, folks, Barbie said. And the picture was so good that several people helloed back. I'm Dale Barbara, and I've been recommissioned as a colonel in the United States Army. A general ripple of surprise greeted this. The video deal out here on Little Bitch Road is entirely my responsibility, and as you may have gathered, there has been a difference of opinion between myself and Selectman Rennie about whether or not to continue the feed. This time the ripple was louder, and not happy. We have no time to argue the fine points in command this morning, Barbie continued. We're going to train the camera on the point where the missile is supposed to hit. Whether or not the broadcast continues is in the hands of your second selectman. If he kills the feed, take it up with him. Thanks for your attention. He walked out of the picture. For a moment, the gathering on the dance floor had a view of nothing but woods. Then the image rotated again, sank, and settled on the floating X. Beyond it, the sentries were packing the last of their gear into two big trucks. Will Freeman, owner and operator of the local Toyota dealership and no friend of James Rennie, spoke directly to the TV.
Leave it alone, Jimmy, or there's gonna be a new selectman in the mill by the end of the week.
There was a general rumble of agreement. The townspeople stood quietly watching and waiting to see if the current program, both dull and unbearably exciting, would continue, or if the transmission would end. 17. What do you want me to do, Big Jim? Randolph asked. He took a handkerchief from his hip pocket and mopped the back of his neck.
What do you want to do? Big Jim responded.
For the first time since he'd taken the keys to the Green Chief's car, Pete Randolph thought he would be quite willing to turn them over to someone else. He sighed and said, I want to let this alone. Big Jim nodded, as if to say, be it on your own head. Then he smiled, if, that is, a pulling back of the lips can be so characterized.
Well, you're the chief.
He turned back to Barbie, Julia, and Scarecrow Joe.
We've been outmaneuvered, haven't we, Mr. Barbara?
I assure you that there's no maneuvering going on here, sir. Barbie said.
Bull. Pucky. This is a bid for power, pure and simple. I've seen plenty in my time. I've seen them succeed.
and I've seen them fail. He stepped closer to Barbie, still favoring his sore right arm. Up close, Barbie could smell cologne and sweat. Rennie was breathing harshly. He lowered his voice. Perhaps Julia didn't hear what came next, but Barbie did.
You're all in the pot, sonny. Every cent. If the missile punches through, you win. If it just bounces off, beware me.
For a moment, his eyes almost buried in their deep folds of flesh, but glinting with cold, clear intelligence, caught Barbie's and held them. Then he turned away.
Come on, Chief Randolph. The situation is complicated enough, thanks to Mr. Barbara and his friends. Let's go back to town. We'll want to get your troops in place in case of a riot.
That is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, Julia said. Big Jim flapped a hand at her without turning around. Do you want to go to Dipper's, Jim? Randolph asked. We've got time.
I wouldn't set foot in that whore hole, Big Jim said.